Welcome. The peace revolution now continues.
Breaker, breaker, 1-9. I'm in outer space with a microphone.
Will you open your hymnal to page 542? Read the first stanza of the poem you find there.
Did the virgins to make much of time?
Yes.
The one.
Somewhat appropriate, isn't it?
Gather ye rosebuds while ye may, old time is still a-flying. And this same flower that smiles today, tomorrow will be dying.
Thank you, Mr. Fitz. Gather ye rosebuds while ye may. The Latin term for that sentiment is carpe diem. Now, who knows what that means?
Carpe diem. That seize the day.
Very good, Mr.
Meeks.
Meeks. Another unusual name. Seize the day. Gather ye rosebuds while ye may. Why does the writer use these lines?
Because he's in a hurry.
No.
Ding.
Thank you for playing anyway. Because we are food for worms, lads. Because believe it or not, each and every one of us in this room is one day going to stop breathing, turn cold, and die. I'd like you to step forward over here and peruse some of the faces from the past. You've walked past them many times. I don't think you've really looked at them. They're not that different from you, are they? Same haircuts, full of hormones, just like you. Invincible, just like you feel. The world is their oyster. They believe they're destined for great things, just like many of you. Their eyes are full of hope, just like you. Did they wait until it was too late to make from their lives even one iota of what they were capable? Because you see, gentlemen, these boys are now fertilizing daffodils. But if you listen real close, you can hear them whisper their legacy to you. Go on, lean in. Listen. You hear it?
Carpe.
That was weird.
But different. Spooky, if you ask me.
Can you test us on that stuff?
Oh, come on, Cameron. Don't you get anything?
What? What?
Shut up, listen, and learn.
Remember, all I'm offering is the truth, nothing more.
You are fully capable of deciding your own destiny. The question you face is, which path will you choose?
Everything you do in life, every choice you make, has a consequence. When you do things without thinking, you ain't making the choice is making you.
It is not our abilities that show what we truly are. It is our choices.
You are what you choose to be. You choose.
This is something only you can decide.
No lifeguards watching anymore. You're on your own. You're your own man, and the decisions you make now are yours and yours alone from here until the end.
Everything that has a beginning has an end.
Believe it or not, each and every one of us in this room is one day going to stop breathing, turn cold, and die.
It is simply a matter of time.
Nothing ever truly dies. The universe wastes nothing. Everything is simply transformed.
Our lives are streams flowing into the same river.
And so we are all connected in the great circle of life.
You cannot escape your destiny.
Train yourself to let go of everything you fear to lose.
Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it.
Our lives are defined by opportunities. Even the ones we miss.
This is the way things are. You can't change nature.
Change is nature, Dad. The part that we can influence. And it starts when we decide.
The future is not set.
There is no fate but what we make for ourselves.
No fate. No fate but what we make.
Two little mice fell into a bucket of cream. The first mouse quickly gave up and drowned, but the second mouse, he struggled so hard that he eventually churned that cream into butter. And he walked out.
Size matters not. Look at me. Judge me by my size, do you? And where you should not. For my ally is the Force. And a powerful ally it is. Life creates it. Makes it grow. Its energy surrounds us and binds us. Luminous beings are we, not this crude matter.
The Force will be with you, always.
But beware of the dark side. Anger, fear, aggression. The dark side of the Force are they. Easily they flow, quick to join you in a fight. If once you start down the dark path, forever will it dominate your destiny, consume you it will.
Don't give in to hate. That leads to the dark side.
Your anger gives you great power. But if you let it, it will destroy you.
Always remember, your focus determines your reality.
Begin each day as if it were on purpose.
Without purpose, we would not exist.
Don't ever let somebody tell you you can't do something. You got a dream, you got to protect it. People can't do something themselves, they want to tell you you can't do it. You want something, go get it. Period.
You don't just live in life. You change it, you shape it, you make your mark upon it.
What I'm talking about is the human spirit. That's the challenge, that's the voyage, that's the expedition.
The powerful play goes on, and you may contribute a verse. What will your verse be?
You must strive to find your own voice. But the longer you wait to begin, the less likely you are to find it at all. Thoreau said most men lead lives of quiet desperation. Don't be resigned to that. Break out.
You must be imaginative, strong-hearted. You must try things that may not work. And you must not let anyone define your limits because of where you come from.
If you focus on what you've left behind, you will never be able to see what lies ahead.
When you are calm, at peace.
Your mind is like this water, my friend. When it is agitated, it becomes difficult to see. But if you allow it to settle, the answer becomes clear.
Be whoever you want to be.
But you're never going to be the same person you are right now.
So my advice to you is to get it right this time around. Because this time is all you have.
Find the joy in your life.
All right, I'll give it a try.
No! Try not. Do. Or do not. There is no try.
Though grown-ups represent the greater part of any community's purchasing power, children very definitely are an influence in the purchasing of everyday commodities.
Children have participated for a very long time in the consumer marketplace, but in the past, children's consumer culture was a cheap little culture.
Every afternoon, the kids make a beeline for the Seminole 5 and 10, a terribly misnamed candy store. It should be called the Seminole 1 and 2, because that's the way Alice and Frank Smith make their living, a penny at a time.
Well, it's penny candy because kids only had pennies.
Kid, this is a toy you've got to have.
Look at the fun Debbie and Andy are having with these realistic Ride-Em toys.
Although it's true there was advertising to children back in the 1950s, the 1960s, even in the 70s, the amount of it was very confined in comparison to today.
You want to get a slinky.
Advertising to kids may have been confined during the 70s, but it was during this period that it would come into its own as an industry, triggering a counter-movement to end youth marketing altogether. and setting in motion a series of policy decisions that would ultimately determine the industry's future.
A seminal event was in the late 70s when the Federal Trade Commission advocated a ban on advertising to children 8 and under.
The Federal Trade Commission staff believes that children are deceived by television advertising, particularly commercials for cereal with sugar in it, and it wants to stop all advertising aimed at young children.
This ban was based in part on concern about sugar cereals and cavities, and also based on research that indicated that children 8 and under did not understand the persuasive intent of advertising.
Well, when I was a kid, Hopalong Cassidy was on television. He was like one of the first children's programming.
Here he comes, here he comes.
It was only after he became so successful that they developed a lunchbox. Now they developed the lunchbox and the dolls before.
The Star Wars Ultimate Lightsaber.
I mean, this is why people like George Lucas have said, I am not a film director. I am a toy maker.
Everything Star Wars.
Chewbacca is recording ringtones for a cell phone company. Star Wars, the marketing force, has married its name to a pile of products, including masks, dolls, lightsabers, hats, snacks, cups, more snacks, wind-up toys, action figures, cereal, and even a best-selling book.
And so, with deregulation, a new world had been opened to marketers. Free now to turn the most powerful emotional attachments of kids into unheard-of profits.
Their goal is to insinuate their brands into the fabric of children's lives.
So many children's characters' principal function is really to hook kids on products. They're designed to pull on kids' heartstrings.
It's your chance to make the Little Mermaid part of your world.
And then who's holding the strings? Well, it's the marketers who want to sell kids a wide variety of products.
So you end up having junk food promotions at fast food restaurants, breakfast cereals with images of the main characters from the movies. You have bed sheets so the children literally go to bed thinking about the images. And then they go to school with their backpacks and their lunch boxes with the logos. And then they get to school and their friends have on the t-shirts and the shoes and they want them.
Hello, Scooby-Doo crackers.
Scooby-Doo? Do you like those?
Yeah.
Have you ever had them?
No.
How do you know you like them?
So.
SpongeBob SquarePants was Kraft's best-selling macaroni and cheese. I personally know a 5-year-old who told her father in no uncertain terms that SpongeBob SquarePants macaroni and cheese tastes better than any other macaroni and cheese. Now, how do you argue with a 5-year-old about that? I mean, what do you say? You say, well, no, it doesn't. And then she says, well, yeah, it does. Well, no, really, it does. No, it does. I know it does. Well, have you ever had SpongeBob SquarePants macaroni and cheese? No, but I know that it tastes better.
Growing up is a very strenuous, difficult, and sometimes hard and scary process for children. One of the things that gives them some stability and continuity in that is their attachment to touchstones in their lives. And among those touchstones are characters. Clifford the Big Red Dog, Mickey Mouse. These are constants in their lives. These are things that they have figured out, they feel they understand, and that they feel comfortable with, and indeed, in their own way, love. When you take that and you leverage that into saying, you know, eat this food, you are basically leveraging that very powerful emotion that the child has, that very powerful attachment, to make money.
Volunteers from the local Home Depot have arrived at this school in Kitchener, Ontario to build a playground.
Okay. Home Depot has given our school some money so that they are going to help build us a playground.
The deal is the schools raise one-third of the costs, $10,000, and Home Depot provides the rest in materials and volunteer labor. and everybody gets to feel really good about it.
We at Home Depot believe in volunteerism, and we believe in giving back to our communities, and it's just part of our DNA.
So 250 adults, role models for the kids, get to pat themselves on the back after a hard day's work. The school saves money and gets a playground. And Home Depot? What Home Depot gets is access to the fastest growing market in Canada. Our children.
How many of you have been to Home Depot? Absolutely wonderful. Point the direction that Home Depot is.
Head office of the hardware giant Home Depot has committed to building 1,000 playgrounds in 1,000 days all over North America. This is more than a playground. It's a strategy. What corporate America has done in the last few years is target education. It's become a specific marketing ploy.
As governments squeeze education spending, corporations are increasingly filling the void, giving generously in return for new marketing opportunities. It's more than simply providing vending machines and team uniforms. Some businesses are finding ways to influence what children are taught. Critics say it's all aimed at teaching them to be good consumers before they're taught how to be good citizens. Here's filmmaker Jill Sharp with Corporations in the Classroom.
Go!
In all species, children, babies are protected against predators. How come within our own species we allow some people to use knowledge in psychology and use this knowledge to heal people and use it to abuse them? That's horrible. That's antisocial. It's not loving children. It's abusing them to make them wish this product.
It's never been harder to be a parent than it is today. Because children are growing up in a commercial culture that is toxic for them. I mean, sometimes parents don't even know the kind of marketing that's going on in schools.
With the McDonald's fitness program, there will be money for new gym equipment and free apple slices for the kids. But this doesn't solve the funding needs for every community. But in Palmer, with money even tighter, the administrators are hoping to go ahead and get $5,000 in exchange for morning broadcasts like this one.
Bus Radio.
That sucks. Tickets at busradio.com. We'll choose a name at random, and if you're the winner, we'll give a pair of tickets to your bus driver, too. You guys can hang out together, maybe share a large Coke.
Ball fair over third and down the line.
Email us as soon as you get home. Sucks tickets at busradio.com.
As Bus Radio expands into four states, they may soon head north. But that's not all the corporations have in mind for enhancing public education. If you think they're watching too much TV at home, just imagine 7 million kids forced to watch commercial messages on school TV as part of the morning class.
One of the questions that comes up periodically is to what extent could a corporation be considered to be psychopathic? And if we look at a corporation as a legal person, that it may not be that difficult to actually draw the transition between psychopathy in the individual to psychopathy in a corporation. We can go through the characteristics that define this particular disorder one by one and see how they might apply to corporations. They would have all the characteristics. And in fact, in many respects, a corporation of that sort is the prototypical psychopath.
You want to really take the power away from the biggest corporations? You want to really punch them in the dick and shit in their punch bowl? Then follow this tried and true plan of action. Stop buying so much shit. Just stop it. Just stop it. Every time you buy a thing, a trinket, a widget, a custom design, whatchamacallit, you give them a little more power and a little more money. The moment you stop, they will flip the f*** out like a redneck on Jeopardy or a Kim Kardashian at a talent contest or an Indonesian six-year-old Nike employee listening to an American six-year-old bitch about how hard his homework is. or Thomas Paine at a present-day Tea Party rally going, why the f*** are you wearing those ridiculous hats? Or Charlie Sheen anywhere. They will flip the f*** out. The reason our economy keeps trucking along while Americans can't find work and our social safety net has holes in it bigger than Rick Perry's logic is because we all keep buying stupid, vapid and fighting each other for large TVs and ridiculous houses. The moment we put down the iPads and Xboxes and pocket rockets, the large corporations will feel the pinch. We all know the expression, vote with your wallet. But we need to vote by putting down our wallets, cutting up our credit cards, making do with the hordes of crap we already have. Give your kids a cardboard box for Christmas, draw a big X on it, and tell them it's an Xbox. Kids is stupid. They'll believe anything. And if nothing else, it will prepare them for being homeless in 15 years if we continue down the path we're on. I'm Lee Camp, and that's your moment of clarity. Get more of these at leecamp.net.
You know, quite a few years ago, when Bill Clinton was inaugurated, was in one of his speeches, he recognized one single individual as being very important to him philosophically. And that was a bit of a surprise because I knew about the individual. And some of you may know about him, but it's worth looking into. And his name was Carol Quigley. He wrote the book Tragedy and Hope. Now, the important part of Tragedy and Hope and Carol Quigley is that he claims that he was on the inside and part of the group that, you know, did the planning. But why did he write Tragedy and Hope to expose these people behind the scenes? Because he believed they were far enough advanced, it didn't have to be secret, they could be out in the open, and this is the way it works. It's a tragedy if you don't accept this, and there's hope if you know who runs the show. That's my interpretation, but I believe it's correct. But let me read a quote from him. And thinking about where he's coming from, he says the argument that the two parties should represent opposed ideals and policies, one perhaps the right of the right and the other of the left, is a foolish idea acceptable only to the doctrinaire and academic thinkers. Instead, the two parties should be almost identical so that the American people can throw the rascals out at any election without leading to any profound or extensive shift in policy. I mean, I think that is profound statement because it tells us what's going on and why things don't change.
There is a peaceful solution called the Peace Revolution. Now let's take back America.
Welcome to the Peace Revolution podcast. I'm your host and navigator, Richard Grove, and this is where we step out of the confusion, fear, and anxiety of everyday life to relax into some knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. You're listening to Podomatic's number one rated podcast in higher education. Thank you for making time in your busy schedule to tune in and grow in the light direction. If this is your first time listening to the Peace Revolution podcast, this podcast acts as a virtual classroom for adults, designed to point out and provide useful resources and information. Each episode contains a subject of study essential to a comprehensive understanding of reality, all of which is focused on providing you with the history, context, references, and the various methods and tools so that you can learn for yourself that which public schools cannot afford to provide. Peace Revolution and all the educational media we create here at TragedyandHope.com is presented as a public service without corporate sponsorship, and it's published commercial-free and presented free to the public. Thanks to the generosity of the subscribers, the Tragedy and Hope online community, and the hard work of the media hosts featured at TragedyandHope.com. I encourage you to check the episode notes, references, and links for this and all episodes we publish at peacerevolution.org. I also invite you to click on the invitation link in the episode notes and participate in the Tragedy and Hope online community and learn how to apply this journey of discovery to your everyday life. If after studying the episode notes you're looking to learn more, Peace Revolution also has several partner podcasts, which likewise feature commercial-free educational episodes free to the public, including CorbettReport.com, GnosticMedia.com, MediaMonarchy.com, RemedyRadio.com, and many others, each of which uniquely fills the void left by public schooling. Now, if I might add some foreshadowing to the next several episodes of this podcast, episodes 41 through 45 will contain the 5-hour interview with John Taylor Gatto, in audio format, of course. And along with the help of some of our podcast partners, we'll have a roundtable discussion for each episode as we screen the interview and sift through the copious amount of historical references. Episodes 41 through 45 will each feature and focus in on an hour of the Gatto interview, broken into 15-minute segments, and then we'll comment on it for 15 minutes, repeating this 4 times, so that each episode will contain 1 hour of interview and 1 hour of commentary, wherein we can help put it all together by illustrating the references, footnotes, and providing you with a map which actually reflects reality. And if studied, can expeditiously expedite your rate of satisfaction in life by learning how to dispel confusion. That being said, The Ultimate History Lesson, A Weekend with John Taylor Gatto, in video format, will soon be shipping. I'm chipping away at it, and it's nearing the point of public release. Once we do publish and proliferate it via our network of educationally minded affiliates, the estimated prices for the DVD set will be $65, that's 4 DVDs, and $75 for the 50GB Blu-ray disc set. However, if you're listening to this, even after we've published this project publicly, you can donate $50 using any of the donation buttons on this podcast, in the notes, on the sidebars of TragedyAndHope.com and PeaceRevolution.org, and you'll receive either the Blu-ray or the DVD set. Think of it as a benefit of listening closely and paying attention. With over 5 hours of interview footage, this is a collection of historical epiphanies that's relevant to everyone, and it's the perfect piece of media to help you break through to those who don't have enough contextual information to connect the dots. You can invest 5 hours, 5 weeks, or 5 years into reviewing this archive of what they won't teach you in schools, as it could take that long to read all the references, to dig through the primary sources, and to read all the books. But at the end of that 5 years, you'd have an education which is superior to that being produced by any Prussian PhD system. Now to today's episode. It was challenging to lend a title to this episode. I had several which seemed to be too wordy, such as the Corporation of Education, Commerce in the Classrooms, How Corporations Consume Children, and many others. But now that the title decision has been made, let me explain the ideas embedded within the opening montage. First, I started with some Dead Poets Society, because schooling uses fear to control us, and to liberate ourselves, we must learn to understand that death is a fact for us all. And now that we've internalized that concept as adults, how might we best be living our lives? Next, I thought it'd be nice to have some of the philosophical ideas which could help us to live our lives and thrive in life, ideas which public schools don't make clear to us, but there are times when Hollywood films do actually yield a little wisdom which is actually useful in our everyday lives. I then queued up some sample audio from the documentary film Consuming Kids, which I'll feature in its entirety around the 1 hour and 30 minute mark of this episode, which I then followed with a sample from the film The Corporation, with Dr. Robert Hare, who discusses the many similarities between megacorporations and psychopaths. I then played a rant from Lee Camp, who presented us with the idea of a detailed plan to decrease corporate power, which I then followed with Dr. Ron Paul discussing Dr. Carol Quigley's 1966 book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. Moving on to the content of the remainder of this episode, when I'm done with my introduction here, I'll be continuing on with James Corbett, discussing the history of corruption in public education, upon which time I'll then cue up the audio from the film Consuming Kids, which begins around 1 hour and 30 minutes of this episode. After Consuming Kids, we'll go back to Dr. Hare and the idea of corporate psychopathy for about 5 minutes, around the 2 hour and 30 minute mark of this episode. And then moving to our last feature, Corporations in the Classroom, which begins around 2 hours and 35 minutes in this episode. Also, you might be interested in checking the episode notes, especially note 29, which details how schools will be used to control the population as slaves, and note 30, which details that before it was in our schools, kindergarten was the first level of initiation into the Bavarian Illuminati. But to me, all the points in the notes, the links, the references of each and every episode are interesting, as we're all studying our birthright, which has until now been obscured by clouds of propaedeutic deceit and noble lies. I'd say more, but this episode is already saturated with more than you'll need to start to see clearly why our public schools are broken and who benefits from the incoherence produced in America by public schooling. And I guarantee that this is the only public classroom in which you'll be empowered with the information to make your own decisions. Because it's not about telling you what to think. It's about giving you the tools to learn for yourself. This is episode 40, Consumer Kindergarten. How corporations prey on children. Thank you for your support, and thank you for tuning in and not dropping out.
Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and it is the 22nd day of September 2011 here in Japan, and today I'm honored to be joined on the line by none other than Richard Andrew Grove, the infamous gang leader of TragedyAndHope.com, and also the man behind PeaceRevolution.org, and many other things and projects besides. Richard Andrew Grove, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thanks for inviting me back, James. It's a pleasure.
All right. Well, it has been quite a while since we've talked, so I'm glad to be doing this. And today we're going to be biting off more than we can chew, I'm sure, in one conversation on the history of corruption in public education. But I guess in order to start setting the groundwork for this, I think it's important to let people know about an exciting new resource on this topic that you're going to be coming out with very shortly, The Ultimate History Lesson, A Weekend with John Taylor Gatto. So perhaps you can tell the listeners a little bit about this project and its history and sort of the details about when it's coming out.
Sure. The history on it is that for various reasons that I'll leave out of this direct interview, I've been looking into how the world actually works as opposed to the map they give us in public schools, because I had some experiences go on in my life that let me know that the map that I was given of reality was not indicative of reality. In fact, the map that we had all been given, I found, through public schools actually leads us into these pitfalls and these rabbit holes and all these sort of things. So I've been trying to get to the bottom of it and to figure out how we could have such problems around 9/11 and competency of the investigation thereof, how we could have this ongoing 10-year war without goals really established, let alone war being established, and how there's like a multitude of different subject areas, whether it's our water being poisoned, the air being poisoned, the food being poisoned, all these different things go on. But when you get to the root cause of how does this a group of elite managerial class type people pull the wool over the eyes of the general public? And in trying to answer these questions for myself, I found out that if you go back and actually study the history of how American public education formed, there's a lot there to be sifted through that is directly relevant to 9/11, the war on terror, everything that we're experiencing today, including this massive financial collapse, albeit slow, right? The dominoes are falling, but they're falling at a slow rate. So what we can do is observe this pattern of history that keeps repeating and observe what they took out of our public education system and then package that up and give it back to people directly. And so that's what I've been working on.
That is a noble quest, my friend, because I think looking for the patterns in history is in some ways a very simple task, but in some ways it's been taken away from us. It's been put out of our reach. And I certainly hope that that more people are tuned into this and are looking for those patterns in history to find out where we have been to in order to figure out where we're going. And I think this resource will be a handy way of doing that. So tell us a little bit about what this will actually physically be.
Physically, it'll be either a single 50-gigabyte Blu-ray disc that'll play high-definition 1080p of the 5-hour interview, or it'll be 4 DVDs in a box set. And it'll completely be fleshed out with, it has footnotes and everything already in the film itself. So when you watch it and Gatto talks about a certain book or a certain quote or what have you, I've already gone through and footnoted the book, the pages and the chapters for almost everything in there. There's over 200 footnotes during the 5 hours. We've also gone through the trouble of getting an accurate transcript created, and we're also going to provide many of the tools that we can give out for free that have been taken out of public schooling. So the five-hour interview is not meant to totally or comprehensively encompass anything. It's more a ramp. And as you listen to each hour, the ramp builds up until you finally get to the crescendo in hour five to see what it all means. And when you understand the patterns of history that have been formed that are so blatant, and people might have heard about this point or this point or this point, but no one's ever heard all these points explained together in context such that a family can sit together and truly have a learning experience. And you can spend a weekend watching this DVD set. You could spend 5 hours, 5 weeks, 5 months, 5 years, because it would actually take you that long to comprehend and read all the source material that he's referring to. However, at the end of that five-year education, you would have an education that is superior to any PhD degree that's being given out at any university on the planet.
Absolutely incredible, and I'm extremely excited for this. I'm very much looking forward to it, and especially because I'm well familiar with John Taylor Gatto and his incredible work in this field, but perhaps we assume too much of the listeners. I know my longtime listeners will be familiar with Gatto, but for those who aren't, perhaps you can give us the synopsis of who he is and where he comes from.
Sure. The title of the project's An Ultimate History Lesson, A Weekend with John Taylor Gatto, and Gatto is he's a school teacher. He's from Western Pennsylvania. I'm from Western Pennsylvania. So I found an affinity for the poetic nature of his writing, because he's not just conveying information, but he's doing it in such a poetic fashion that when you look at what he's been able to teach kids in public schools over 28 years, and then how he ended up resigning because he learned that he was being used to hurt children. So he resigns on the op-ed page of the Wall Street Journal. He then goes on to write, I think, 5 or 6 books on the topic of what is our public education system, who designed it, what is its actual purposes, what are the real ways that you get into college, what are colleges really looking for, what's the real way you get a job, what are employers looking for. So he's touched on all these topics because what he noticed was this: the way the system is set up. Let me make sure I answered your first question. Gatto, to this day, is active. He recently suffered a stroke and is recovering, but he'll be going forward and continuing to speak maybe by next spring or summer is what I've heard. So what we have is a school teacher who spent his entire career up until his, call it early retirement, he spent his entire career serving kids and trying to do his best within the system. And what he discovered was that the system actually uses the best teachers against everyone else, because they show that a broken system is continuing to work in these limited instances.
A broken system indeed, and broken in so many ways, and broken on purpose. And I think that's really part of the key history of what's going on here, and I'm sure that will be explored. But again, this is an exciting project. How will people actually be able to get their hands on it?
We'll be making the DVD available at tragedyandhope.com, johntaylorgatto.com, corbettreport.com, mediamonarchy.com. And the idea is that because this is a project that needs to be seen by a wide audience, what we're going to do is we're going to put the video up for free in a watermarked form on YouTube, so that people who don't want to buy the DVD set and just want to access the information and the notes and what have you have that access. And then for, you know, individuals and families and organizations that want to have the actual DVD set to study from, we're accepting donations now, because we're in post-production and haven't actually finished it yet. So people in the past couple of weeks who have donated $50 or more have gotten on a list of the early screenings of the first edition. And then from them, we'll productize it and make it available across many different sites that are either independent media sites that are commercial free, or other educational, alternative educational sites that are trying to get the word out.
Excellent. Well, again, some exciting stuff. So I really do hope people will stay tuned to tragedyandhope.com for more on that, and will hopefully join the Tragedy and Hope community to become a part of the conversation, as I understand, 1,000 voices and growing.
Yeah, there's about 1,200 people in there, and you know, there's many people that subscribe to the podcast, and then a small percentage of those people take action because they want to take these next steps and figure it out. But I also understand that there's a lot of people who are hesitant because they don't understand what that's all about. Basically, what we provide is provocative media that's fact-based and reflective of reality, and we put it out to everyone for free. We also recognize the responsibility in doing that is I'm not just going to put this media out there and not give you a next step. We have a community where if you want to go in and find other people who are likewise trying to answer these questions, you can come into the community, you can act as an individual and go through all the tools yourself, but there's also a chat. There's also many groups in there where people want to work together because they're beyond just learning about these things, and now they're trying to get back to the civic activities that rebuild their communities in actuality.
Indeed, I think that is another crucial piece of the puzzle, and it's one that's not really available through CorbettReport.com at this time, so I'm glad that Tragedy and Hope is doing that, and I really do hope more people will get on board and will join that conversation. Well,
and you know that's open to your audience, man. It's not a mandatory thing that anyone has to pay. We just make sure that each individual is a human being, and if you appreciate the services that we provide and you can help us out, cool. And if you're struggling or unemployed or trying to get back on your feet, use the resources for free. That's what they're there for. But we just want to make sure that individuals are human beings and not spammers or predators.
You have to be a human being? What do you got against reptoids, man? Come on. All right. Okay. Well, absolutely. Well, having said that and sort of established a bit of a groundwork, I'd like to get into the meat and potatoes of the conversation because, again, this is just such a huge topic, the history of corruption in public education. I mean, so much can be said about this, but I guess as a basis for starting out, we should perhaps start examining the system that of education that is not taught to you and me and the lowly minions out there, but that's taught to the elite level, I guess, rulers of society. And that phrase, I think, has a lot of caveats to it, but I think it generally goes to show the way in which this society is unfortunately being ruled. So let's start talking about the private boarding school system and where that came from and what it really teaches the managerial class of society.
Well, that's a fantastic question because that is the essence of what we're not being taught in public schools. And if you trace the origins of the private boarding schools, with the exception of possibly six, they were all started post-Darwin's publication of The Descent of Man in 1871 or 1872. Therein, Darwin explains, because he didn't in Origin of Species connect evolution to humanity. He just shows, and he never shows an origin of any species. Yet the forgotten name of his book was Preservation of the Favored Races, which he carries on in Descent of Man. So the point being, there's a bunch of elite aristocratic managerial class nobility, if you will, and they decide that they don't want their kids breeding with, for instance, the Irish, who were the lowest on Darwin's scale of 57 different races. And so in order to keep their kids from breeding with just anybody, they developed boarding schools. And so this all falls in line with the intermarriage among the elites and how they like to keep everything closely knit together. So these private boarding schools are teaching kids how to manage the rest of us. And they teach them a variety of methodologies, but some of the more insightful ones, which would help people understand what's going on, are the same things that you and I have had to do on our own outside the public education system, which are investigate the history and evolution of institutional forms, whether it's the prisons or the Democrats or the Republicans or anything that we see around us. We should have an idea of its origins and history and how it came to be in order to be educated and understand, you know, at least our community. The other things they teach are things like theories of human nature. What makes different people from different parts of the world tick? What things you have to say to certain people in certain vernaculars, whether they be Christian or atheist or what have you, in order to appeal to their beliefs. So the managerial class in private boarding schools, they're taught how to use words to manipulate other people to get what they want. One of the other things they teach would be mastery of the social forms, how to adopt the different mannerisms to take on and interact with different parts of society, to make them think that you're, you know, so it's like teaching kids how to use sheep's clothing. As if you're a wolf, right?
Very, very good analogy, I think, in many ways. But that's, I mean, those points you touch on are so important, because I think we are either trained or we just inherit a worldview in which all of those things which are interrogated in the private boarding school system are just accepted as part of sort of a static, unchanging reality. And so that people just accept the fact that there is Democrats and Republicans, there is a prison system, there are all of these institutions which obviously have come through and developed through a philosophical process throughout history, but we're taught to ignore that history, not think about it, and just accept these things as something that's always been there, monolithic entities that cannot be questioned. Similarly with theories of human nature, similarly with ways of communicating to different social groups. Again, all of these things are just accepted in our worldview, and when you actually start to interrogate where they come from, you can actually look at the ways in which they're used to manipulate us.
Well, that's fascinating, because you mentioned a philosophic perception, which would be reminding me of the panopticon. And then when you're talking about the social evolution of prisons, for instance, because if you look up Jeremy Bentham and the idea of the panopticon, it is the, you know, the nanny state that we have here with the smart grid technology and everything spying on you, but you think it's your friend, right? Facebook's your friend, right? It's not a spy. And so, looking at this, Gatto says the same thing. It's the first question that I ask that elicits this answer, but he says, the only way I know what I think is that I sit down and I write it out and I argue with myself. And I think too few of us are given those tools to constructively question and argue with ourselves in order to find valid answers. But that's not the only tool they don't give us in public school. I haven't necessarily found evidence that they do give this out at all the public boarding schools. But these are tools that have been taken away from both sets of classes, which also makes the elite managerial class irrational. Tools like how to manage yourself and manage your time, right? They don't give us a way in public schools to know ourselves. They're not giving us organizational skills to manage our life or keep it in order. They don't give us a method by which we can validate the contents of our mind. They don't give us a method by which you can tell when people are lying to you. There's all these methods of, you know, for instance, resolving disputes and conflict. There are methods that do all these things that we find to be challenging or irritating or frustrating or confusing or fearful. There are methods that cut right through all these things. So anytime that we come up against fear or confusion, we have a method that translates that directly into knowledge and understanding. And so it's just an input you process and you have an output. So once you have these tools and methods back, which is, you know, what we're bringing out through the Gatto interview set and some other projects we have. Once you have these tools and methods back, you have a great serenity and clarity of mind and ability to focus and actually get things done in a practical manner. But you know, the managerial class that's trained at private boarding schools, they don't necessarily need these tools because they have unfair advantage already.
That's absolutely right, but I think perhaps instead of thinking of the ruling class, the managerial class, as a monolithic entity in and of themselves, I mean, I think there must be different strata within that class, and there are those who are meant to be the mid-level gophers, and perhaps they're not given the same education as the people who are meant to be the real sort of technocrats.
That is an astute observation, so let me give you a specific instance. When we met with Jamie Johnson, who's the heir to the Johnson & Johnson family, he's technically a billionaire. When we met with him, he had been educated at NYU, which isn't an Ivy League school. I'm sure he had been to private boarding school, but he looked like a deer in the headlights the entire time I was explaining to him all the layers of evidence in whatever area you want to look around 9/11, the war on terror, everything going on with that. Your audience is very familiar with this. So when somebody who is supposed to be a lot better off than me and a lot better schooled than me is looking at me like it's the first time they've heard any of this stuff, and they really can't believe it, they can't reconcile it, cognitive dissonance is setting in with every fact that I'm setting in front of them, because it does not compute. And at that point, I realized it doesn't matter, because I'd watched Jamie's made two movies now, Born Rich and The 1%. Back when we had first met with him, I had just seen Born Rich, and there's the Cy Newhouse heir. There's several heirs to family fortunes in that film who have around $1 billion. And all of these kids looked lost and confused. And all I thought was, wow, that there's hope, because if you put the right information in front of these kids who, yes, they're in those families, but they don't have the legacy. They're cut out of their companies. They are kept aside from everything that's going on. Jamie had nothing to do with the company. It had been, you know, out of his family for generations. He just still gets paid, right? And so the idea of trying to package up this information so that it's palatable, building out a ramp instead of saying, hey, here's a 100-foot cliff, now climb it, because this is reality, right? So we've taken the time to build out a long ramp that's really, you know, a slow incline so that everybody can get on wherever they can step onto it and start walking up in small increments, because it's your life that we're talking about. So this is going to be going on for the rest of your life until we all get together and figure out what's going on, how to resolve it, and actually take those actions. So you got to plan for the long haul. You got to get organized. You have to be serious about this. Otherwise, you're just, you know, you're wasting your time.
And that's exactly why I think I would, any day of the week, I would prefer knowledge and understanding over mere wealth, monetary wealth. I think it's just so sad to hear about that. I mean, people who literally can go through their entire life without ever needing to learn anything or to really understand how anything works. That's a waste of a human life, regardless of how much money might be in the bank account.
Well, now we've talked about what public school is not. So let's define what public school is. Public school, notice it's not called public education, it's called public schooling. The ideas behind public schooling, whether today or 2,000 years ago in Rome, were, you know, to teach the people how to be, you know, to teach crowd control, to teach things to the masses that enable them to be controlled by the few. It's an artificial extension of childhood in the last 60 years, because you can look at the textbooks from the 1950s. These textbooks speak about the importance of independent thought, how to have debates, all these sort of things that you would need to have a healthy community and strong civic responsibility. Those textbooks have been changed drastically in the last 60 years, and the purposes of schooling they've lost their facade, where, you know, the facade of it's actually about education, and it's gotten down to it is about indoctrinating and training habits and making sure that everyone in the class thinks it the same way about certain things. That makes everyone predictable. It makes statistics and forecasting predictable for the government, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, so this started in its most realistic form in 1918, and there's a book that is cited by Gatto in the interview that once we heard it, we're like, we all got to look this book up. So several of us have attained copies of it. It's called Principles of Secondary Education. It was printed in 1918, and it's a Yale book. So, or maybe it's Harvard. But the point is, in there, this guy Ingalls defines the six purposes of education. And the people who have created the whole system, they've been working off a plan. So these six steps have continued to remain in effect till today. So when you think about, what do we still use from 1918, aside from things like Federal Reserve? But there's not a whole lot from 1918 that we still use in its current form, except the design of public schooling. And so the design of public schooling gets around these six points, and the first being the adjustive function. This is the establishment of fixed habits of reaction for each student. So if there's a fire, everybody acts a certain way. If there's some other accident, everyone acts a certain way. If someone says this sort of thing, everyone reacts a certain way. So it's Skinnerian or Pavlovian programming of students. The second is the integrative function, which is the development of like-mindedness, unity of thoughts, habits, standards, ideals, all the sort of things that we're supposed to aspire to. This is where we got the notion of the American dream. This sort of thing is instilled through school. This is why they need us for 15,000 hours. It's not just about education. The third is the directive function. It tells you what you're to do. It marks you in your social class for, are you going to be a plumber? Are you going to be a technician? Are you going to be an engineer? Are you going to be a doctor? These sort of things. So part of the teacher's job is to label you and to basically set you on this path for your future. The differentiating function is to assure social solidarity, takes advantages of differences among students to divide and conquer, and ensure they don't have enough upward mobility in life. So it cements you in your social caste. You're labeled. It's the teacher's job to label you. And then you're set in your social caste, and you're not supposed to really be mobile from that, which is the same thing that Darwin says or the Anglican religion says, because these things are all tied together through the phenomenon of schooling. The fifth would be the selective function. This is the elimination of individuals who do not meet the managerial class's criteria for future workers. So if you're a bright, intelligent, curious young person who likes to learn, guess what? You don't really fit in the corporate world. They don't want people with integrity and morals and ethics and standards and, you know, protocols of how to get things done. They don't want that. They want good little worker bees who aren't going to question anything. And the propaedeutic function, which is the sixth, is there to identify the next managerial generation of the elite. So these are the people who are going to run things, and they don't need people who aren't in that class to learn how to run things. That doesn't really fit in with their system. So what you find is you've got this strange functioning of the public school system. So the question is, why do public schools have that form and function? Well, to answer that question, you look at where does it originate? Public schooling in its current form today originates back in the early 1900s with the Vanderbilt family, the Astor family, the Carnegie family, the Rockefeller family, all these robber baron families who created the teachers' pensions and then gave teachers tenure, which is a guarantee that they can't be fired as long as they play along with certain rules. And this is enough to get teachers to lie to our children for the past 100 years. It's a system that keeps working, so they haven't fixed it yet. How am I doing?
Oh, I think that was a mouthful and a half. Well, Rich, as someone who prides himself on his vocabulary, I must admit I have never in my life encountered the word propaedeutic or even could guess at the etymology of that word. So that's something that on my to-do list, look up that word.
I'm pretty sure it's a Greek word and it has to do with adults and children, but I would likewise need to do some more epistemological nomenclature research on that.
Interesting. But, well, the AE kind of gives it away as, I think, a Greek etymology. But anyway, absolutely fascinating stuff. And just my observation on that, as someone who has not only taught in the education system for several years, but actually taught in Japan specifically, I must say that the Japanese do an absolutely marvelous job of those six functions and really do follow them to a T. And to me, what that suggests perhaps most interestingly is the way in which the cultural imperialism has really spread this idea out throughout the globe, because having read a fascinating history of some of the historical educators here in Japan, I know that this is very much not the way that education used to function in Japan. So I think there's been a very concerted effort to really introduce this system and to make it part of the system, probably, I imagine, introduced during the period of American administration after the World War II. So absolutely fascinating stuff, and it is spreading out across the globe. And the question really, I guess, is how to stop it.
Well, the way to stop it is by learning. Let's learn 2 more minutes of history about Japan and the Prussian education system, which is what I was just referring to, because it's the importation of Prussian education to America that corrupts the entire education system. I happen to know, because I interviewed Gatto and he talks about this, and it's fascinating what you can learn when you interview somebody, right? He tells this great story about Admiral Perry and how Japan was really opened up to trade, and it was by threat of force and coercion and fraud and all these beautiful things that are the American way. But what he says thereafter really shocked me, and it was that because of how this character Wilhelm Wundt, who created the Prussian PhD system, so anyone who has a PhD today, the lineage goes back to this guy who created it, Wilhelm Wundt. Wundt lived in Prussia. And they came up with the idea after they had lost this war against Napoleon at Battle of Jena in 1805, that the reason that their soldiers lost is because they're too well educated, and that people who are really well educated don't make good soldiers, because you do logical things like ask questions while you're fighting and while you're risking your life and these sort of things. So they wanted to dumb down their entire population to make them a militaristic society. It worked so well, they then exported it around the world. And in the late 1800s, Japan loved this idea so much that they imported the Prussian constitution almost word for word. So if you see a Prussian influence in the education system there, it's not alone. It doesn't stop at China either. Gatto said he's been to China 6 times. They keep wanting to they know that they're controlling people like machines, and they want to keep it that way, but they want the people to be more happy as they're being treated. They want them to learn to love their servitude. And so this is just the irony of, you know, you have nations who understand that, yes, we're treating our people like they're machines and have no soul, but we want them to be happy about it. And will you help us figure it out, right? And so it's by learning that history that we can put a stop to it, because it's only when you are not intellectually able to defend yourself or physically able to defend yourself that you get into trouble. The big deal is that most people, you're not fist fighting every day. This isn't, you know, the Wild West. This, you know, we don't need violence, but we do need intellectual self-defense because we are being attacked on a cognitive level, bombarded every day, all day. And if you have the methods to dispel confusion and to be able to deal with these things and see them in their totality, in their context, in a comprehensive nature, you're much better able to learn about them, figure out what the moving parts are, what they've taken out, and how to put it back. It all becomes very simple once you take away the complexity.
Absolutely. Fascinating, fascinating stuff. I mean, I must plead ignorance of the history of Japan. I mean, I know about Admiral Perry and the opening up of Japan to outside trade during the Meiji era, but I don't really know about the importation of the Prussian Constitution. But that does certainly make the penny drop in terms of, you know, the formation of the German-Japanese axis back in World War I, World War II. It's absolutely fascinating stuff. So definitely I need to do more self-schooling on that topic. But again, I think it goes to show the exportation of this cultural system that has unfortunately been taken over by a lot of governments that, of course, like to keep their people dumbed down and unquestioning and try to make them happy while they do so. I guess we've touched on this a little bit in terms of who's responsible for public schooling. You pinpointed private schooling origins in Darwin, but how about public schooling? Where does it come from? Who does it come from? What are the philosophical roots of this system?
Well, traditionally in civilization, since there have been towns and communities and what have you not, kids were taught at home, usually by their parents, and if not, they had a local teacher. And this was all done informally, non-governmentally. It was done, you know, with form and function in mind. And what you have is that comes up through, you know, the Dark Ages. That's just people are still being taught at home. And up through about 1300, 1400, the first organized public schools appear in Scotland, but only kind of as a function of the Templars' exodus, it seems. What you have then is the schools being put together by communities, so you do have public schooling, but there's no mandate per se. And when you get around to universal, mandated, forced, you know, compulsory schooling, which is what public schools are all around the world, they have truant officers and school taxes and all these sort of other sort of things. This was all created more recently in the last 100 years by the rich aristocratic elite robber baron families like the Rockefellers, Carnegies, Astors, Vanderbilts, early 1900s. Around that time, Standard Oil was having a lot of problems with labor. And there was the Ludlow massacre. There was all these sort of things that were drawing attention to the nature of these corporations and their capitalist antics that were against, you know, human survival in many cases. And there was this, I believe he was a Baptist minister named Frederick T. Gates, who approached Rockefeller and he said, "Look, you got to let me handle your money. You need this thing called philanthropy. It's going to convince everyone that you're a great guy." And so Rockefeller and Gates partner up. Well, then Rockefeller creates the General Education Board. He invests millions of dollars into it, and then he appoints Frederick T. Gates to be the first, you know, executive director of this General Education Board. So what you have are people like Carnegie, who also had labor problems, learning how to buy the public. And you buy the public either through your foundations or your donations, or in Carnegie's case, he donated an organ to all these different churches. And then, of course, even though he's an atheist, all these churches thought he's a great guy. With Rockefeller, he had multiple philanthropies, but the Rockefeller Foundation and its affiliate foundations, the Ford Foundation and some of these other ones, Carnegie Foundation, Carnegie Endowment, are all instrumental in creating and mandating from the top down the public school system in America. And during the 40s and 50s, the Walsh Committee in 1918, and then the Cox and Arese committees in the 1950s that looked into the origins of foundations and the nature of their antics and activities with schools. And what they found was the elite, corporations that had created these foundations as proxies were then being used to undermine everything about the American way of life and the Canadian way of life and Japanese way of life by removing and redefining. More importantly, it's a process of redefining their culture. And so when people come in and spend a lot of time with you and take you away from your parents at a young age, you become very, you know, influenced by those people. And especially if you think they're there to help you and to teach and make you learn or help you to learn. But in reality, what you find are kids are stripped, literally stripped, of their curiosity, their creativity, their self-reliance, their self-esteem. Anything that could make them a solid, responsible grown-up eventually is stripped away, and that leaves somebody who has to be totally dependent, you know, like a adolescent for everything. You think you know what's going on as a teenager, but you really don't. You're not paying the bills, you know, at that know-it-all age. They've created a whole culture where no matter what age you are, you think you know what's going on, and yet you've never put any research into defining anything around you, so you depend on what people have told you it is. And even though there's a lot of, you know, well-meaning, well-intentioned people, are they well-informed? Are they using their five senses and observing reality and finding something that's objective that actually exists? Or have they skipped all those steps of verifying their reality? And are we discussing something that's arbitrary and insubstantial and actually a waste of our time, a rabbit hole? There is a way to get to the end of the rabbit hole, but you have to ask the right questions in the right order, and that's the methodology.
Absolutely. Well, I think you bring up an important point of all of this, which is not only that the children are being taught not being taught how to think, but that I think societally, culturally, in terms of our civilization, we've been taught how not to teach. And you bring up the point of historically, most cultures have the concept of parents raising their children and teaching them what they need for survival. And it's amazing to think that we've really managed to strip that away and make that seem like a foreign or strange concept where it just seems natural to give our children to government agencies to rear and raise and to indoctrinate from the time that they're basically old enough to walk and talk.
Well, and it seemed natural to give those organizations known as public schools the rights to have, you know, mandatory vaccinations, because you have a bunch of kids coming together and viruses or bacteria can be communicable, so we should protect against that. That seemed like form and function matched up back then. But when you have a school system today, which is all only there to condition and program your child for a future life in the status quo, and at the same time, in some states like California, they're going to make the Gardasil injection mandatory. And not just Texas, where they said they did it, but they didn't really do it. There's a document on the governor's table in California right now where schools are going to do this. And I've already seen so many other inhumane actions taken by schools, such as the drugging of children. If your kid has too much curiosity and is perceiving too much of life, they've got a problem, and we have to put them on this drug for the rest of this life, their life, right? And so it now just becomes a sales depot for pharmaceutical, you know, organizations and police and tactical and security organizations and all these other things that have nothing to do with education. If you asked what are the steps to learning, it works like this. You have to be able to observe. You use your five senses. You then ask valid questions and find substantial answers. That's it. If you know how to do that, you've now learned how to learn anything. And it didn't cost you anything but little, you know, 30 seconds of attention and actually focusing on what I was saying. But that's the secret. College and public schools and all these things were not created for the purpose that we have all assumed. And I would never believe this had I not spent thousands and thousands of hours researching and looking into this to find the source materials to then help, you know, create this interview set and put all the footnotes and references in there. So it's not just a, you know, a word or a phrase that goes over your head. You know, the only way to learn is to pause the disc, write it down, look it up, just like what you said when I said propaedeutic. Propaedeutic. You know what I'm saying?
I think I do. All right, well, I guess the question really becomes, to what extent is our freedom, the possibility of our freedom, predicated on our ability to think critically?
Well, if you don't have the ability to question propaedeutic, that's a fun word to say improperly. If you don't question the words you hear, I'm just using it as an example because I think it's about our habits. They control us by our habits. And so you had the habit of asking yourself the question, is that a word I know? Do I need to look it up in order to understand the sentence? Well, I defined the word by its context, and you were able to understand what I was saying, even though you didn't hear this word before, right? So that's all it is. It starts with the questioning in the mind, your internal conversation, where it's no longer just stimulus and response. You're putting thinking in between the stimulus and response. And what is thinking but asking the questions and attaining the answers of the who, what, where, what, why, and when, and how of the situation. The five W's plus how is what I'm trying to say. And if you answer those five questions, that's thinking. You're actually doing thinking between your input and your output. That makes you a human being, in my opinion. You have to be thinking. There are plenty of people who let stimulus and response control them, and they're no longer consciously participating here. They've turned themselves into scenery, and I think that's kind of sad, but everyone has the choice to just start asking questions, because if you don't start somewhere, you'll never get started. But if you just ask a couple questions, let nature take its course. You can get out there. The information is out there. We try to put it all in one place and give people a map to it, because it's so massive. You can delve into any of your favorite areas, something that, you know, if you're a professional and you have expertise, you can look at, you know, something that's applicable that you could easily understand. But the point is that with a little bit of concentration, all of this is understandable, and that the people that are ruining this planet don't really understand what's going on, which is why they've taken so many irrational, you know, actions and plans. They're just really organized and good at it, and they don't get organized resistance. That's the difference between the managerial class and the rest of us, is they're organized. They have a plan. They have an agenda. They think that, you know, they have justification, whether it be from God, you know, through the Bible, or through science via Darwin, to be and act as justified sinners, which means that nothing they do is going to damn them, and that nothing we do is going to save us. And I think we can do better than that.
Justified sinners telling noble lies, I guess. Absolutely. Well, that does raise so many important points, but one point that occurs to me is that if really what I'm seeking is nothing other than the nullification of their plans, is that a plan in and of itself?
Well, sure. If it's wave cancellation. I don't see the need to be dominant, but I do see the need to stop letting their signals dominate me. I call their signals noise, because it's the anti-human actions that they're trying to put into all of us. Whether it be, you know, here's a pretty girl, buy the product, or any of these other things that they do to manipulate people. You have to say no to that, starting with your observation and your unwillingness to take in those signals anymore, because they don't contain signals that help you survive and thrive. Rather, they're giving you signals that are contradictory to human survival. They're doing all sorts of things that are irrational, and I guess that's why you and I are doing what we do every day, because we see that it's irrational. It doesn't have to be this way. And that, you know, if we just put back the pieces that they've taken away, if we give people back their ability to be self-reliant, to think clearly, to get things done that, delivers consistent, achievable results, that's it. That's all they had to take away from us to make us incoherent as a nation and as individuals.
Indeed. Well, I think you and I are very much on the same page, because to me, again, it comes back to the idea of not wanting to create some sort of overarching system or telling people what to think or anything of that sort, just simply trying to detach people from the system of control that they've tried to set up and engineer for us. And I think, obviously, learning how to learn is an absolutely crucial step in that. And it's the first step, and there are many steps to come after that, but I think if without that first step, we'll never start the journey.
Well, and there's a quote that I find to be poignant when you get to this place where you're trying to understand these sort of concepts. And the quote is, between stimulus and response, there is a space. And in that space, I'm continuing on my own now, in that space is where your freedom comes from, because it's in that space where you make your choices. It's in that space where you ask questions and actually go out and seek some more information, because you don't have enough information yet to make an informed decision. Right? It's in that space where all the freedom comes from. So if we don't take on a process of getting organized, thinking, that's asking questions, and learning, that's answering those questions and noticing the patterns, then, you know, there's no hope. But if we do that, there's plenty of hope for individuals to act, you know, with self-reliance and be able to not have their actions injure anyone else or impede, you know, infringe upon the volition of others. So as long as we all have the ability to make informed decisions, the volition returns. There's no need for, you know, people talk about anarchy. Anarchy is just the absence or vacuum of government. It doesn't automatically give the people back self-reliance and critical thinking and these methods of survival and thrival. So, you know, you see a situation like the economy building the way it is or any of the other things. It's sad. It's kind of gloomy. But the point is, it doesn't have to continue to be that way when these tools, when these solutions, when these methods are so close to getting out there to everybody. All it takes is a little attention on your part to realize the value of it and the nature of it, and then the astuteness to pass it on to others who are, you know, looking for answers and actually trying to participate in this game called life.
Tragedy and hope, one might say, as long as one remembered to append .com to that when entering it into an address bar in your browser.
Absolutely. You're so good with the puns. I let the noble lie go, but I want to say to your audience that James here in 2007 was talking about Strauss and the noble lie well before, you know, because I've been talking about it for the past couple years, and I was just humbled to see that you were so far ahead of the curve, and that because it's a very potent idea, the fact that there is this noble lie, that Plato comes up with it, that it's been carried on as a philosophy, that the neocons use it, that the people who did 9/11 subscribe to this, and that the noble lie only works when the audience is so believing. And I say, let's just not be so easy to convince. Let's make people actually show us evidence, and I would like to learn something during the process, right? And I think that this would all go on a lot more fluidly once we all realize that we need to have a method to identify that which exists and to dismiss that which doesn't. That makes the whole crime of 9/11 a lot easier to solve when you're not chasing things that don't exist, right?
I agree 18,000% with that, and I think absolutely that cuts both ways, because just as people can be fooled and tricked by the establishment, they can be tricked just as easily by the alternative media and people who just don't use their critical thinking when looking at facts, and they can lead you down speculative rabbit holes that go nowhere, and I think people definitely have to have their critical thinking in place and use it as their shield when they're battling their way through this this incredible struggle to try to find the truth about anything, and I think too many people just leave the establishment to join the alternative flock, and it's no better really in many senses.
And the only way that it's going to get better is for us to notice some of these recurring patterns. So we just talked about Plato and the idea of a noble lie. Let's go 1,000 years ahead in time and look at Johann Fichte. And Johann Pestalozzi and Caspar Lavater, these were all people influential in creating the Prussian education system. Immanuel Kant, and then all these people influenced Hegel. So everyone knows about the Hegelian dialectic. Well, here's all the philosophical influences that gave Hegel his boldness, right? I'm trying to say Hegel more the way it's supposed to be said, so I'm saying Hegel now in case you're questioning that.
I wasn't, but I am now.
You should, because in the interview said, I didn't say Fichte properly. So now forever when people see me say Fichte, they can have a little giggle, because I did some learning that day. So Fichte, Pestalozzi, Lavater, Hegel, they all were either in the Illuminati or had Illuminati mentors. Caspar Lavater, who created some of these first kindergarten-type experiments in Switzerland, experimenting on homeless children, et cetera, these all have Illuminist ties, and the whole agenda of the Illuminati was to take away our tools of learning. That the Trivium is not only the Masons' high secret, it's at the end of Morals and Dogma on page 861, it's the royal secret of the Sublime Prince, is the 3-4-5 triangle, and knowing the Trivium, Quadrivium, and your five senses. So the highest secrets that these societies aren't secret, they hold secrets. And what do they hold secret? Useful information that if they withhold from the public gives them almost total control and dominance from an intellectual perspective. They keep us as children and they like to act as adults. And all I'm saying is if we proliferate this information and allow people the opportunity to grow up at their own pace, they don't have to do it in one day, but at least start in the process to develop as a full-blown adult who can have these tools and be confident and self-reliant in reality, instead of based on something that we pay money for at Walmart.
Well put, well put. So yes, the answer to the salvation is not going to come by paying Walmart or paying money in any sense. And that's, again, one of the false solutions that we're taught. What are some of the things that we've lost from the public's, from being subjected to the public schooling system?
Well, we've lost our ability to recognize problems when they happen. I mean, we live in a nation of CSI watchers and NCIS type of, law and order crime solving shows where everything's solved in an hour. You see the crime at the beginning of the show, then they solve it by the end of the show. It's very comfortable. Yet our entire nation is not able to recognize when real crimes are going on, how to dismiss these arbitrary false flags that have government, you know, taxpayer money written all over them. So we've lost our ability to observe when things are out of normalcy because we can't recognize normalcy anymore. We've lost our ability to be persistent and self-reliant. We lost methods of intellectual self-defense, how to dispel confusion, how to test reality to see if what we're actually thinking, talking, doing is actually in, you know, part of reality, or if we're talking about, you know, we might as well be talking about what we had to dream last night, right? Because it doesn't apply to anyone else except it's a subjective experience, right? So if we can move away from subjective experiences, talk about objective experiences, that's where communication can truly start to begin. So we've lost our ability to communicate clearly. We've lost our sense of epistemology, which is a method of acquiring knowledge in the first place. We've had a loss of truth, which could be referred to as solipsism. This is the legacy of Immanuel Kant. And if you look at what happens when you take away objective reality and take away cause and effect, take away consequences of the nature of, you know, natural reality, then you can make anything into the truth and teach it to children. And they don't have any defense because, you know, they're just trusting in their authorities. This, of course, makes everyone reliant on these authorities. We've had a loss of judgment and the ability to make informed choices, partially because we can't recognize what exists. And therefore, we've lost freedom from a number of angles, which results from deleting the thinking between stimulus response. So if we've lost our freedom from that process, let's reverse it. You have thinking between stimulus and response. That equals freedom. Get more individuals practicing freedom in a self-reliant, responsible way where they're not infringing upon the volition of others. Then you have a society that can grow and thrive and be sustainable without any of these crazy corporate foundational Al Gore, UN type of things going on that are trying to get into everyone's lives.
That's a key point, because I think a lot of the solutions that we inherently just naturally know to be solutions are co-opted and corrupted and are taken over and are basically used by the establishment as ways to lead us down false paths. And again, without our understanding of history and how techniques of manipulation have been used in the past, we'll never be able to escape that cycle. So it sounds like people are in need of a history lesson, an ultimate history lesson, if you will.
Yeah, well, they definitely are in need of an ultimate history lesson. Unfortunately, the DVD set that we've created only gets you on their first couple steps. After that, you're going to have to continue taking steps, but I can promise that it's going to be more fun than you thought it was going to be, because there's a lot of interesting people that are also, you know, going on this journey, trying to find the answers to the same questions. You're going to make new friends. You're going to find out new things about life that give you a lot of encouragement and inspiration and the tools that you need to be more successful and to have a more serene mind while you're experiencing all this new information. So you had just said something there at the end that I wanted to let me see if I can recapture it. You lost me, James. You had said something there at the end, and I thought that is such a good – oh, you noticed the pattern that they redefine our terms. That's it. If you like, that's such an astute observation that I just had to trip over myself to comment on it for you. Because Gatto says during the interview that the way that they've taken over culture after culture after culture after culture is to come in and redefine the everything. So it's called liberty, but really it's tyranny. And so this is what they talked about, whether it's 1984 or Brave New World, Huxley and Orwell. These ideas that were just ideas back then are actually being carried out with success now. And to put a cap on it, I'll refer to a Bertrand Russell book, Impact of Science on Society, because in there he's talking about how Fichte had planned to do all this control to society, but he didn't have the technology. And Bertrand Russell's like, now we have the technology to actually do all this stuff, to make people love their servitude. In fact, they won't even know that they're serving. They'll just think they're loving life, but they'll know that there's something wrong with it, and they'll keep being reminded of this every day as they're confused and in fear, right? And so, you know, they've had an easy go of it because we haven't put up much resistance. They've taken away these tools, and nobody is coherently trying to give them back to a large number of people at once. And I'm just interested to see what would happen if you had a bunch of people who regained their individual freedom, had intellectual self-defense, had the confidence to take actions with high degrees of certainty, and to be able to put all these compartmentalized PhD pseudo-experts in their place. Because once you learn, truly learn for yourself using this methodology, you'll see that you have a superior weapon on the battlefield of the info war.
Very well put. Well, I would say that we've been feasted by Fichte, and we can get out with Gatto, but that would be just too punny for a family-friendly program like this. So I think I'll get out while the getting's good. And I think we have bitten off an incredible amount of information in this conversation, so perhaps we'll let the listeners chew on this mentally for a little while. But I guess in wrapping up this conversation, any other points that you wanted to make about this topic?
Well, if we've done anything during this hour-long conversation, it should have stirred up your curiosity a little bit. And so let that marinate, and then when you're ready to start taking some more steps forward and learning, the entire Peace Revolution podcast that I've put out over the past couple years is a curriculum. It's an informal curriculum where you are your own teacher, but you're being given the tools, the techniques, the methods, everything that they've taken out of the public school system, you know, one episode at a time, so it's easy for people to intake. And then from there, if you want to learn more and interact with people and participate in groups and figure out where we are actually at right now, what needs to be done, and how do we introduce this bigger picture to more people, then there's the Tragedy and Hope online community, which is at tragedyandhope.com.
And might I just throw in a little plug for Peace Revolution, because it seems that pretty much every episode I either get an idea for an episode of my podcast to expand on something that you've put in there, or you've already covered something I was going to cover, which is great, because that means that, you know, many hands make light work, so that information is out there in the zeitgeist anyway. So it's absolutely an informative podcast, and I couldn't recommend it highly enough.
Well, I think that's just the convection current of causality going on, because I am likewise inspired by your productions as well as Mr. Pilato. And I really couldn't get through my week without them, because you guys both do different things that are very complementary. And I really couldn't feel well informed unless I've had my Media Monarchy and Corbett Report for the week.
All right. Well,
and my Global Research Television, now that you're making these videos, that last one on 9/11 conspiracy theory, man. I mean, you made me laugh. You made me laugh. You made me cry all at the same time. I was like, this is brilliant. So I'm glad to see that you're stretching your wings, that you're getting a lot of support, that people are respecting you for your hard work and your intelligence gathering, and that it's all coming together for you. And as a subscriber to your 100 yen negotiated agreement, I know every time I see that come out every month that it's going to a good place, that I am going to continue to get inspiration and energy and nutritious thoughts. So I'm glad you came out with that, and I hope more people support it.
Well, I thank you very much for that. And without that, without the support of people like yourself and all the other listeners out there that are doing this, I wouldn't be able to do this in the form that I am, and to keep up with all the, you know, the technology and all the stuff that we need to do these types of media enterprises. So absolutely thank you to you and to everyone out there who is supporting the Corbett Report, and also Media Monarchy and Peace Revolution and all of the other various independent media that are out there attempting to spread the word about this and succeeding or failing in various ways, but hopefully just adding to the overall enlightenment of society. And again, it's just a question of educating yourself and helping to educate others once you've learned those first few steps. So it is an incredibly overwhelming process, but we're in it together, and I guess we'll either hang together or we'll hang separate. And unfortunately, that can be taken quite literally. So
no, that's a good historic pun to close it down on, because I think you're punned out by now.
I think I've given it my best. All right. Well, Richard Andrew Grove, once again, always a pleasure to talk with you, and always an honor to be involved with Tragedy and Hope and all of the things that are going on there. So once again, I hope people will go there and use that as the springboard or a starting point if you haven't done so yet. Anyway, we will leave it there for now. So once again, thank you for taking the time to talk with us today.
The feeling is mutual, and thank you everyone for tuning in and not dropping out.
Not since the end of World War II, at the height of the baby boom, have there been so many kids in our midst. There are now more than 52 million kids under 12 in all in the United States, the biggest burst in the U.S. youth population in half a century. And for American business, these kids have come to represent the ultimate prize. An unprecedented, powerful, an elusive new demographic to be cut up and captured at all costs. There's no doubt that marketers have their sights on kids because of their increasing buying power, the amount of money they now spend on everything from clothes to music to electronics, totaling some $40 billion every year. But perhaps a bigger reason for marketers' interest in kids may be the amount of adult spending that American kids under 12 now directly influence, an astronomical $700 billion a year, roughly the equivalent of the combined economies of the world's 115 poorest countries.
One economic impact of children is the money that they themselves spend. The money that they get from their parents or grandparents, the money that they get as allowance when they get older, the money that they earn themselves. That is an increasingly significant amount of money. But that's not where the real money is. Marketers and advertisers have realized that the real money related to the children's market is in their purchasing influence.
Any questions? Jared, does it do any tricks? Does that work for you?
Because of their purchasing power and because of their purchasing influence, marketers and advertisers have become much more deliberate in their strategies and attempts to how to influence those dollars.
Sienna, because kids come first.
It's the children who often determine what kind of car gets bought, what kind of computer gets bought, what kind of cell phone program, and even where they take family holidays.
What's your favorite part of the Nick Hotel?
The awesome pools.
Having my own room.
The arcade rocks.
I like the shops.
I like eating with SpongeBob.
They came on vacation and the kids don't ever want to leave.
Most parents and other people just don't realize how corporate marketers intentionally try to, well, in essence, make parents absolutely miserable. Corporate marketers have actually studied the whole nagging phenomenon, which corporations do nagging better, and they provide advice to corporations about, you know, what kinds of tantrums work better.
Children sometimes say, you know, can I, as much as 9 times.
Will you take us to Mount Splashmore?
No.
Will you take us to Mount Splashmore?
No.
Will you take us to Mount Splashmore?
No.
And part of the nag factor is designed to help maximize the number of times children will keep asking and keep asking.
No! If I take you, will you two shut up and quit bugging me?
Yeah, of course. Well, will you take us to Mount Splashmore?
Yes!
Thanks, Dad.
So these kids have a lot of power in the economy. The advertisers know it. And they are going after them in a way that is unprecedented.
It's the place where
this generation of children is marketed to as never before. Kids are being marketed to through brand licensing, through product placement, marketing in schools, through stealth marketing, through viral marketing. There's DVDs, there's video games, there's the internet, there are iPods, there are cell phones. There are so many more ways of reaching children so that there's a brand in front of a child's face every moment of every day.
What we have is the rise of 360-degree immersive marketing, where they try and get around the child at every aspect, at every avenue.
Kids are inundated with this. They are buried in this. Buried in this media blitz.
Kids are now multitasking with media.
Hello. Hey, girl, what's up?
No way.
Plug in your iPod or MP3 player.
Yeah.
They are using more than one medium at the same time. So they're surfing the web, and the television's going with MTV, and they've got the iPod with one earbud in, and they are more vulnerable and are bombarded with over 3,000 commercial messages every day.
Marketers know these are little sponges. They're so wide open, and they want to get that brand loyalty for life, because that's big bucks.
It's about people wanting to convince our children that life is about buying. Life is about getting.
Can I help you?
Yeah, I'm here to see this.
Go ahead.
So the philosophy becomes cradle to grave. Let's get to them early. Let's get to them often. Let's get to them as many places as we can get them.
Do you have a business card?
Sure.
not just to sell them products and services, but to turn them into lifelong consumers.
I'll see you in about 20 years.
Though grown-ups represent the greater part of any community's purchasing power, children very definitely are an influence in the purchasing of everyday commodities.
Children have participated for a very long time in the consumer marketplace, but in the past, children's consumer culture was a cheap little culture.
Every afternoon, the kids make a beeline for the Seminole 5 and 10, a terribly misnamed candy store. It should be called the Seminole 1 and 2, because that's the way Alice and Frank Smith make their living, a penny at a time.
Well, it's penny candy because kids only had pennies.
Kids, this is a toy you've got to have.
Look at the fun Debbie and Andy are having with these realistic Ride-Em toys.
Although it's true there was advertising to children back in the 1950s, the 1960s, even in the 70s, the amount of it was very confined in comparison to today.
You want to get a slinky.
Advertising to kids may have been confined during the 70s, but it was during this period that it would come into its own as an industry, triggering a counter-movement to end youth marketing altogether and setting in motion a series of policy decisions that would ultimately determine the industry's future.
A seminal event was in the late 70s when the Federal Trade Commission advocated a ban on advertising to children 8 and under.
The Federal Trade Commission staff believes that children are deceived by television advertising, particularly commercials for cereal with sugar in it, and it wants to stop all advertising aimed at young children.
This ban was based in part on concern about sugar cereals and cavities, and also based on research that indicated that children 8 and under did not understand the persuasive intent of advertising.
Are you saying that every message directed to the older child, a child between 8 and 12, right, is inherently deceptive?
That's right. I think the child cannot bring enough information to bear not to be deceived and to have an unfair trade practice.
So what ended up happening was the industries that were going to be affected, the toy industries, the sugar cereal companies, went to Congress.
And that in an American democratic capitalistic society, we all must learn, top to bottom, to care for ourselves. And what the last thing we need in the next 20 years is a national nanny.
And Congress ended up taking away a lot of the FTC's authority to regulate marketing to children.
Far from addressing consumer advocates' concerns about the impact of advertising on kids, in 1980, Congress passed the FTC Improvement Act. The law mandated that the FTC would no longer have any authority to promulgate any rules regarding children's advertising.
The Congress of the United States, under pressure from advertisers and marketers, actually took away from the Federal Trade Commission the right, the authority to regulate advertising and marketing to children.
And what little remained of government's power to regulate children's advertising would be dealt a final, fatal blow in the early 1980s.
Government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
In the 1980s, this country was in a situation of falling in love with the market, thinking that the market was the solution to everything, and of deregulating industry.
For those of you with television stations, I have an announcement. As you know, I've never liked big government, and I think you will agree there's no reason to substitute the judgment of Washington bureaucrats for that of professional broadcasters.
By 1984, the Reagan administration had completely deregulated children's television. All bets were now off.
Corporations now realized that Congress was not going to do anything to restrict their power to marketing to children, and they now actually had more power.
And lo and behold, a lot of really smart marketers discovered children as a huge market.
In the decades prior to deregulation, kids' consumer spending increased at a modest rate of roughly 4% a year. Since deregulation, it's grown a remarkable 35% every year, from $4.2 billion in 1984 to $40 billion today, an 852% increase.
Deregulation really opened the floodgates for a kind of marketing to children that
never existed before the mid-1980s.
And the masters of the universe!
Suddenly, it became okay to create a television program for the sole purpose of selling a toy.
No one can stop the spike-studded armor of the mighty Spikor! Not even me, you muscle-bound porcupine! Not even you, He-Man!
And sure enough, in the year immediately following the congressional action, the 10 best-selling toys were all based on kids' television shows. It was the beginning of a new era for childhood marketing.
A few years after deregulation, when the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle movie came out, there were over 1,000 products linked to the movie. There was also the TV show children were seeing every day, and there was the comic book that slightly older children started to look at. It was a saturation of the whole childhood culture.
Well, when I was a kid, Hopalong Cassidy was on television. He was like one of the first children's programming.
Here he comes! Here he comes!
It was only after he became so successful that they developed a lunchbox. Now they developed the lunchbox and the dolls before.
The Star Wars Ultimate Lightsaber.
I mean, this is why people like George Lucas have said, I am not a film director. I am a toy maker.
Everything Star Wars.
Chewbacca is recording ringtones for a cell phone company. Star Wars, the marketing force, has married its name to a pile of products, including masks, dolls, lightsabers, hats, snacks, cups, more snacks, wind-up toys, action figures, cereal, and even a best-selling book.
And so, with deregulation, a new world had been opened to marketers. Free now to turn the most powerful emotional attachments of kids into unheard-of profits.
Their goal is to insinuate their brands into the fabric of children's lives.
So many children's characters' principal function is really to hook kids on products. They're designed to pull on kids' heartstrings.
It's your chance to make the Little Mermaid part of your world.
And then who's holding the strings? Well, it's the marketers who want to sell kids a wide variety of products.
So you end up having junk food promotions at fast food restaurants. Breakfast cereals with images of the main characters from the movies. You have bed sheets so the children literally go to bed thinking about the images. And then they go to school with their backpacks and their lunch boxes with the logos. And then they get to school and their friends have on the t-shirts and the shoes and they want them.
How was Scooby-Doo crackers?
Scooby-Doo? Do you like those?
Yeah.
Have you ever had them?
No.
How do you know you like them?
So.
SpongeBob SquarePants was Kraft's best-selling macaroni and cheese. I personally know a 5-year-old who told her father in no uncertain terms that SpongeBob SquarePants macaroni and cheese tastes better than any other macaroni and cheese. Now, how do you argue with a 5-year-old about that? I mean, what do you say? You say, well, no, it doesn't. And then she says, well, yeah, it does. Well, no, really, it does. No, it does. I know it does. Well, have you ever had SpongeBob SquarePants macaroni and cheese? No, but I know that it tastes better.
Growing up is a very strenuous, difficult, and sometimes hard and scary process for children. One of the things that gives them some stability and continuity in that is their attachment to touchstones in their lives. And among those touchstones are characters. Clifford the Big Red Dog, Mickey Mouse. These are constants in their lives. These are things that they have figured out, they feel they understand, and that they feel comfortable with, and indeed, in their own way, love. When you take that and you leverage that into saying, you know, eat this food, you are basically leveraging that very powerful emotion that the child has, that very powerful attachment, to make money.
Who's
Celebrate Walt Disney Pictures and Walden Media's presentation of The Chronicles of Narnia, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. You can get a pop-up storybook and an out-of-this-world action figure in every McDonald's Happy Meal.
But marketers have not limited themselves to dropping the names of beloved characters to sell their products. With increasing brazenness, they've also begun to drop the products themselves directly into kids' entertainment.
Hey, look at that!
Is it a mirage or just product placement?
Hey, who cares? With shopping convenience at such low prices, water, Fresca, Mountain Dew, your product name here.
Product placement is weaving of products into programming without adequate disclosure.
Welcome to Wendy's. May I take your order, please?
Classic triple lettuce, tomato, and cheese.
Classic triple lettuce, tomato. I got it.
Classic.
Chicken nuggets.
What kind of toys there?
And so it's dishonest advertising. It's deceptive advertising. It sneaks by children's critical faculties and implants its messages in kids' brains when they're paying less attention.
American Idol, which is a top-rated television program for 2 to 11-year-olds, is just rife with Coca-Cola product placement.
American Idol is brought to you by Coca-Cola.
The Gilmore Girls eat Pop-Tarts for breakfast.
Are you enjoying your breakfast?
I don't know if I like Pop-Tarts.
Did you fall on your head while you were sleeping?
I don't know. Do I like this? Is this something I like?
Children's films have product placement in them. I mean, with Spy Kids had McDonald's as a plot point. And also product placement is getting more and more prevalent in video games.
And when ads haven't been serving as a backdrop in video games, they have become the video game.
With children now as likely to be on the internet as in the playground, they're exposed to so much advertising, they learn to ignore it. That's why advertisers love internet games. Not just ads, not just games, they're advergames. She can score with Skittles, race with Chips Ahoy, or hang out with SpongeBob.
It's part of this by any means necessary. I mean, we've got to get to the kid. We've got to make sure that that child is indoctrinated as a consumer cadet. So therefore, we've got to get to them in ways that maybe they don't even know that we're getting to them.
This new world of advertising in entertainment and entertainment as advertising no longer seems to recognize any boundaries, especially with the rise of new media technologies.
Children with cell phones have become a prime target for marketers selling products. It's because one in four American kids between the ages of 8 and 12 has a cell phone. That's 5 million children. And that number is expected to double in the next 3 years.
Cell phones make children much more vulnerable to advertising. It's advertising literally right in the face of a child.
And I can get all kinds of themes, ringtones, and lots of cool games, like Pirates of the Caribbean.
Disney and Nickelodeon now have downloadable content for cell phones.
Watch videos, catch cast interviews, interact with a favorite Wildcat.
Companies are using text messaging in order to reach kids. I mean, if your child has a cell phone and that cell phone has internet access, then your kid's being marketed to, you know, in ways that you don't even know. So we have to stop thinking of marketing to children as just commercials. I mean, commercials are just so 20th century.
Introducing Nick Tropolis, a huge new world just waiting to be explored by you.
With more than 40 million kids online daily and growing, perhaps no tool has become more important to marketers than the internet. And advertisers are making sure to hit kids where they gather, where tens of millions of elementary age kids are coming together to chat, play games, and watch videos, all while being immersed in the brand.
Welcome to Webkinz.
At Webkinz, for example, millions of kids a day chat with each other, explore, and shop in a virtual world, a world open only to those who go to a designated store and buy a $15 stuffed animal imprinted with a secret code that allows kids to join and enter the Webkinz world, where they are encouraged to shop some more. One of the reasons marketers covet these sites is because of their proven ability to gather personal information from kids.
The internet allows people to be micro-targeted. If you have the person's birthday, you could say, "Happy birthday, Billy. Have you seen the new Power Ranger watch?" It's very personal.
If you set up 5 different accounts from 5 different geographic areas on different genders, on different ages, with different preferences, you will see 5 different ads. You will see 5 different worlds. Now, as a child, you don't know that. As a child, you're competing with MBAs. You're competing with some of the smartest people out there.
In the face of these developments, many critics of youth marketing have called on schools to develop media literacy curricula to help kids navigate commercial culture. The results have sometimes been less than encouraging.
Now a word from our sponsor. That's how some schools are making extra money, literally selling themselves to advertisers.
Everything from the band chill.
That will be $125,000.
To the lecture hall.
$150,000.
Can be named for a price at New Berlin schools.
There's advertising on school walls, on school buses, and gymnasiums. There's donated scoreboards that have the Coca-Cola or the Pepsi logo on them.
There are so many ways that commercialism has intruded into our classrooms. There's Coke and Pepsi and Cadbury Schweppes in the schools, which are helping to generate an epidemic of childhood obesity among our kids across the country. There's school book covers. There are sponsored educational materials. There's a company called Field Trip Factory, which takes kids to places like Petco and to Sports Authority and calls that education.
These Chicago kindergartners are on a school field trip, but the animals they're going to see aren't in the zoo.
We want to welcome you to Petco.
Across the country, a growing number of schools are taking America's classrooms to America's malls.
And there's a new company called Bus Radio, which is trying to compel a million kids to listen to 8 minutes of advertisements per hour as they ride the school bus.
Bus Radio.
BusRadio.com. We'll choose a name at random, and if you're the winner, we'll give a pair of tickets to your bus driver, too. You guys can hang out together, maybe share a large Coke. Email us as soon as you get home.
There's Channel One, which compels about 7 million children to watch ads in schools each school day.
Today on Channel One.
The purpose of schools, in part, is to promote reason. And the purpose of advertising is to subvert reason, to promote the sale of a product. And for that reason alone, advertising has no proper place in the schools.
How often does a company realize that they're going to get a captive audience where people literally have to watch their message? The effort to create junior consumers no longer stops at the school door. It is now following kids into school.
But if it's been following kids into schools, it's also been coming out of our schools in the form of advanced academic research, producing a new class of child marketing experts armed with some of the most formidable scientific tools.
Psychologists and anthropologists and sociologists and behavioral scientists are used by marketers to really shape and cement children's brand preferences. They want to be part of the fabric of children's lives.
12 years ago, there were no youth conferences where you looked at more effective ways to market to kids. Now, there are probably 15 a year, different conferences on tweens, teenagers, the Latino community, how to reach youth with your product, your program, your packages, your characters, your advertising campaign, how to reach them more effectively, how to get more of their dollars, which is marketing, and you can't blame people for that. But is it balanced with more conversations, more discussions of what's good for kids, how can we move our society forward in a healthier way? No.
Child psychologists and other psychologists are now absolutely integrated within the marketing field, and their techniques are so widespread that, in fact, it's probably pretty hard to come up with parts of the marketing effort that don't have anything to do with psychology.
You're a psychologist, you do research, you know the difference between a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old. And you know how to reach a 3-year-old, and you know that you have to play the ad much more slowly and use round figures instead of angles, because children like round figures at that age. And you know that 5-year-olds have a whole different set of concerns, so we can fine-tune the marketing to communicate better with children.
One means of fine-tuning is the tried-and-true method of the focus group.
It's quiet, it's controlled, there's usually a one-way mirror, so we can see behavioral cues. It's how they look, it's the look in their eyes, especially with kids who don't have that sense yet of self-monitoring. You know, all their actions are very descriptive. And once we take what they say and then feed that in with how they look when they say it and their behavioral cues, we really end up with a strong measurement of how product affects them.
Still another means is ethnographic research, which, tuned to the goals of marketers, has become a kind of scientific stalking.
They go into supermarkets with them and film exactly how they look at a product, pick it up, put it back down, the way they move around a supermarket. They film them on the playground. They film them in school. They film them eating breakfast. They film them going into their closet and deciding what to wear.
What are the things that you need that aren't in here?
I need a lot of...
They film them talking to their friends. They organize little friendship circles and film what they're doing. They even follow them into the bathroom. I interviewed a number of people who sat and watched children take baths and showers, watched how they interact with shampoo and soap and health and beauty products, as that category is called, in order to go back and write a report for their clients on, you know, what to do with the packaging. It's creepy. It's just absolutely creepy, the way children are being dissected and put under the microscope by marketers.
This is new consumer science, and it's yielding a new science of childhood. And perhaps nowhere else have the different elements of this science merged so seamlessly as in the Girls Intelligence Agency.
Not the CIA, it's the Girls Intelligence Agency, which, for all the cloak and dagger, is actually a marketing firm.
The Girls Intelligence Agency claims to have tens, if not hundreds of thousands of girls across the country that it is in contact with and working with. The signature product of the GIA is something called the Slumber Party in a Box.
Guys, sacred opening of the cake!
Kids are asked to sort of push a certain product, or they're more like focus group parties where kids are asked to come and give their opinions on products.
What is the hottest item? The sleep mask, the fuzzy phone, or the beauty kit? Fuzzy phone.
They ask them to be sly. They ask them to get information on their friends without their friends knowing about it. It's teaching children to exploit their friends for the purpose of getting money or free products.
What happened at your home the other day, marketing, or was it a party?
It's kind of both. It was a party for us, but it was marketing for the company.
And is that cool with you?
Definitely.
One of the more problematic aspects of its behavior is that it will enlist young children in its marketing efforts without their parents knowing about it.
There's a lot that's happening around us, and the public is not aware, just like they're not aware of neuromarketing. And that's another whole scary thing, to put a child in an MRI and then watch what is lighting up inside his brain based on the stimulus, and then saying, wow, this works, this is good, look what happens.
They do blink tests on kids, for example. They develop ads and then see how frequently a kid blinks or turns their eyes away. And when they see the kid blinking more, they change the ad to make it more mesmerizing. There's stuff they just can't take their eyes off. And it's not an accident. They've gone over and over and over with extensive high-tech kinds of testing devices to find the precise configuration of characters, colors, music, words, and so forth that kids can't resist.
They want to spend time understanding child development, understanding the child's need to belong, a child's need for community, a child's need for independence, to encourage children to buy.
And somebody asked me, you know, Lucy, is that ethical? You know, you're essentially manipulating these children. Well, yeah, is it ethical? I don't know. But our role at Initiative is to move products. And if we know you move products with a certain creative execution, place in a certain type of media vehicle, then we've done our job. They are tomorrow's consumer, the tomorrow's adult consumer. So start talking with them now, build that relationship when they're younger, and you've got them as an adult.
I'll say it. These marketers are very similar to pedophiles, okay? They are child experts. If you're going to be a pedophile or a child marketer, you have to know about children and what children are going to want.
Kids love advertising.
It's a gift. It's something they want. There's something to be said, by the way, about being there first and about branding children and owning them in that way. And antisocial behavior in pursuit of a product is a good thing.
You'll never get away with this, Slippery Sam.
Companies have moved away from exaggerating the product characteristics.
See, his legs actually move just like a real horse. Blaze is the safest, strongest horse made.
To a whole new form of advertising, which is symbolic advertising. The product is pushed not on the basis of what it can do or how it tastes, but of its social meaning.
Run cool! Play cool! Be cool!
So kids are taught to want candy or sugared cereals or soda because it's cool.
Cheesy.
It will define them as an individual. What you buy is who you are.
You get a little love.
There's a mantra in American society. You are what you have. You are what you buy. You are what you own.
I mean, where did she find that outfit? Like, Ugly R Us?
More like Ugly R Her.
We are so funny.
And pretty. I love us.
The corollary of that is, and if you don't have it, then you are less than. You're a nobody. You don't have self-esteem, and this happens even for children.
Nice jacket. Abercrombie?
Please, it's Dior. Why, is yours from A&F?
Our mom bought it for a McKate art.
I think the thing that upsets me the most is that it's not just products that are being marketed to children, but values. And the primary value that's being sold to kids over and over and over again is the value that things or stuff or brands will make us happy.
The costs of participating in the consumer culture for children have escalated dramatically.
I like a bike, I like a pony, but I love it, my first Sony.
15 years ago, the My First Sony, which would be, you know, a kid's version of a tape recorder or a music player, would cost far less than the adult version. But today, it's an iPod. Don't shout, cheat it. In grades, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 even, very, very expensive products. We're seeing elementary school girls, 6, 7-year-olds, articulating adamant preferences for designer jeans that cost $100 to $150. That's part of that shift from children's culture being a cheap culture to a very upscale children's culture in which it's not only branded, but it's designer branded.
Fetch me my Jimmy Choo flip-flops. Where is my pink Prada tote?
It's gotta have it, gimme. That's the value system.
I want more.
Self-indulgence, instant gratification, and materialism.
Everything's got to be perfect for me.
That's the basic consumer identity.
You could try thinking of things that remind you of each note. Do.
Oh, that's easy. Do means money.
It's shallow. It's about me.
Me. Yay, me.
It's about me now, and it's about me and these things.
Law is something you get to break if you're rich.
That's the attitude. It's all about me.
You know it's all about me. You know it's all about me. You know it's all about me. You know it's all about me.
It's really a disservice to kids. I think part of what we need to be able to tell kids is that it's fine to have nice things. There's nothing wrong with having nice things. But don't mistake that for happiness and satisfaction.
In about 20 years, what do you want to be?
Oh, I want to be a baseball player.
A teacher. I want to be a policeman.
When I first started seeing children as a psychotherapist about a quarter of a century ago, I would routinely ask them what they wanted to be when they grow up, and would hear things like a nurse, an astronaut, or some profession that seemed glamorous to them.
By the way, what does your father do for a living?
He designs.
Designs what?
Missiles.
Missiles. And what are you going to do?
I'm going to be a postman.
Now, why do you want to be a postman?
There isn't so much to it, and you can read the postcards.
Around the late 80s, it started to change, and I started to hear children answer that question with the word rich. When I grow up, I want to be rich. I want to make a lot of money. I want to have a lot of stuff.
How we doing today, Squashmaster?
Bacon, bacon, Mini-Me.
And we ain't baking, son, to do
a little shaking.
The commercialization of childhood is permeating their lives. We're talking about a profound remaking of their psyche.
In that world of materialism, kids are not allowed to be kids anymore. They have to grow up fast. We see it in the way they're being asked to dress, the violence they're being asked to navigate, and what's getting squeezed out is childhood.
Marketers even have a name for this trend. They call it kids getting older, younger.
Where's Carla?
Meet the go-to girl of the fashion world, you.
The natural developmental urge is to be older, more mature, faster. No one who is 17 reads 17 magazine. It's the 10 and 12 and 13 year olds who are reading it to understand what it's like to be 17. What is happening is that marketing is taking advantage of that natural urge and selling down to lower and lower age groups.
Manicure and pedicure parties are a big hit for five-year-olds like Talia.
Aren't these gorgeous?
And why wouldn't girls as young as the age of 6 buy cosmetics? Experts say their role models aren't teachers, astronauts, or doctors. Instead, it's the teen idols they're attracted to.
And nothing points to the industry infatuation with age compression more than its invention of the tween.
Club Libby Lou caters to tween girls, like Shelby celebrating her 10th birthday with friends. And afterwards,
look at this is so cute.
Showing mom what a tween girl wants.
It's like bling bling. Like,
and that's just what a CEO wants.
There's a lot of little girls out there, and they have a lot of buying power.
Tween. In between. In between what? I don't know. I don't know what's before tween, because the bottom end of tween is constantly getting younger. It used to be, I believe, 8 to 12, and now it's 6 to 12, and it can get 4 to 12.
And this gives you a clue to some of the perverted thinking that's going on in this field. The idea that a 6-year-old is no longer a child, but is between childhood and adolescence.
Express yourself, girl.
One of the crucial aspects of this trend is that marketers never communicate their adult messages and values to kids simply as kids, but as boys and as girls.
And girls are being taught they need to be pretty, sexy, and what they buy determines their value, and how they look determines their value.
It's true that to some extent, advertisers have always appealed to girls at this level.
Barbie, you're beautiful.
But there can be little doubt that something radically different has emerged over the past few years.
It's my scene, my bling, bling, bling.
New My Scene, My Bling Bling girls are here. Nice bling. Here, wear my ring.
Ooh, sparkly.
You see now dolls with highly sexualized outfits and themes marketed to 6-year-olds.
I go to visit preschools, and I'll see 4-year-old girls in what I often call crotch skirts, modeled after Bratz dolls.
That's so cute. I would seriously wear that.
Thanks. Be Bratz. Be one.
While one part of you, cognitively, may be able to accept belly shirts when you're 7 years old, are you emotionally mature enough to handle the outcome when you go out in public and people look at you like, an underage Britney Spears?
And with boys, we see the same pattern. While to some degree marketers have long targeted boys with what would seem to be adult messages, messages that equate being a man with aggression and toughness and violence, today's boys are immersed in an altogether different world.
Fire! Exciting!
With boys, what we see is the use of images of violence, power, domination at very young ages.
With video games, for example, we went from 16-bit to 32-bit to 64-bit to 128-bit technology in about 5 years. What that means is that we're getting closer and closer to virtual reality.
The amount of violence, entertainment violence, that young children are exposed to is startling. They're getting a message that when you have conflicts, you fight with violence, that you have to fight in order to resolve your differences. That's what you do. And that watching violence is fun.
What the hell is this?
It's entertaining.
The Federal Trade Commission report that came out looking at the marketing of media to children showed that indeed the media industry was marketing material to children that even their own rating systems said were too young for that material.
The studios confirmed to Congress today that children as young as 9 years old were tested for their reactions to R-rated violent movies.
Clearly, there were times during the period discussed in the FTC report when we allowed competitive zeal to overwhelm sound judgment and appropriate standards.
So the very people who are making the product are telling you what's appropriate for kids. And there has been a shift in the space of a decade of one full ratings point. So what was an R-rated movie is now a PG-13. They don't use child development experts in deciding this, and the questions they ask are not, is this okay for kids? It is, would parents let kids of a certain age watch this?
I still masturbate to Pam.
Greg?
Look at those boobs. Man, I just want to lather them up with soap and just...
One thing that happened when the movie studios tightened up on letting kids into R movies was that the sexual content, drug content, alcohol, tobacco, profanity, adult content migrated into the PG-13 movies. So they're a lot more like what R movies used to be.
And a Hollywood movie that's rated for older viewers, PG-13 or R. Has a whole line of toys and products marketed to children 3, 4, and 5 years old.
New, it's the 50s Spider-Man!
Despite growing concerns about the industry's explicit strategy of age compression, its drive to reach kids at younger and younger ages has only accelerated. The result is a massive and growing toddler industry that almost from the womb now blankets babies in brands.
It's really hard to find baby paraphernalia that's not plastered with media characters. You can find unbranded baby stuff, but you can find it in high-end toy stores. But if you go to places where poor middle-class families shop, it's all branded. So the babies start out life with the notion of consumption. And that's not an accident. What they want is cradle-to-grave brand loyalty. That's what they talk about, share of mind. They talk about owning children for life.
Norman Feeney, Pepsi drinker for life.
There's been this recognition, apparently, that children as young as 6 months of age can recognize brands. So now, if they can recognize brands, we've got to make sure that they recognize our brand. The marketer is interested in getting to that child at the very, very beginning to begin to shape that child's worldview, to begin to shape that child's brand preferences, to begin to basically tell the child, in a sense, what that child needs in order to have a meaningful life. And that's where we see, as mothers, that's our job. It's not theirs.
Where to turn in such a world? Millions of parents are now finding some solace in what appears to be a counter-trend. It's a new media movement that claims to be good for infants. And whether we're talking about developmental DVDs like Baby Einstein and Brainy Baby, or 24-hour programming for infants and toddlers on TV, the idea is that good media is the best antidote to bad media.
We don't get to decide how tall they'll end up or what their shoe size will be in 2 years. But how big their imaginations get?
Is that your shirt?
Well, we do have some say in that.
The idea is that our kids would be all right if parents would simply turn their children away from the commercial clutter and turn them on to educational media.
Because kids don't just grow up, they think up.
But the question is, is any of this even true?
There is not one iota of research evidence that shows that they teach children anything, or that the children who experience these things at early ages are any different in terms of their educational capacity or their fund of knowledge later on down the line. It is a huge, hundreds of millions of dollars a year business. And they're selling it to parents' insecurities.
You'll never get into college if you don't play your video game.
They're basically letting parents think that if they don't get these things, their children will be behind.
What will this home video end up being labeled? Kyle and Max in the car? No, Kyle and Max playing.
Cat, we want tea.
Make that Kyle and Max increasing the size of their brains.
The majority of parents think if they don't put their kids in front of media early and often, that they are going to be behind other kids.
And even as this industry has been making big educational claims, it's been making even bigger profits. Sales of infant videos and DVDs purporting to be educational are expected to reach $7.8 billion by 2010.
After her daughter was born, Julie Eigner Clark searched for ways to share her love of music and art with her child. So she borrowed some equipment and began filming children's videos in her basement. The Baby Einstein Company was born, and in just 5 years, her business grew to more than $20 million in sales. Julie Eigner Clark.
This is a billion-dollar industry that is a complete and total scam. There's no evidence that a baby watching a DVD is learning anything.
Educational videos aimed at babies may not be such a bright idea after all. A new study found that children who watch popular DVDs like Baby Einstein and Brainy Baby actually have poorer vocabularies. One researcher even said she'd rather have babies watch American Idol.
The American Academy of Pediatrics has now for 7 years recommended that there be no screen media use for children under the age of 2. And this is for some very specific reasons. First of all, there is no solid scientific research evidence that children under the age of 30 months or 2.5 years can learn anything from an electronic screen. A lot of media early may in fact change the way the brain develops.
Three new studies out tonight are the latest to suggest that heavy television watching can hurt children's ability to learn.
The more television infants and toddlers watch, the greater the chance they'll have trouble paying attention and concentrating during their very early school years.
Researchers say hours spent in front of the TV only trains the brain to watch more TV. A child weaned on bright colors and rapidly changing images will find it tough to focus on a teacher.
During the first 2 years of life, their brain is rapidly developing. And what we know about optimal brain development during these first two critical years is that face-to-face involvement with other people, parents, siblings, other kids, interaction with other human beings, manipulation of the physical environment, trying to stack the blocks up or get a Cheerio in your mouth, creative open-ended problem-solving play is far better than the best edutainment software you could ever have.
What's the most important thing for a 0 to 2-year-old? The single most important thing is the social dynamic, the bond that occurs, and the intimacy that occurs between mother and child. Forget the rest of it. That piece lays the bond of trust and the foundation for all higher learning later. That has to occur. So if you're sacrificing the trust, the bond, the attachment issues for the sake of having a baby Einstein or computer or videos in the room, you're missing a huge understanding of child development. The space that is necessary to think is being jeopardized. You're immersed. You're outside yourself. You're taken out. When do you have quiet time and unstructured time? And when is a child able to be a child and play?
Remember playing baseball until it got so dark you couldn't see the ball any longer? How about hiding and pretending you couldn't hear your name being called home to dinner? That was back, of course, when kids, and just about all kids, played outside starting the moment they got home from school. That was before Xbox, of course.
A recent report from the American Academy of Pediatrics found that commercial media is radically transforming the way children play. The report found that even though free and unstructured play is essential to the cognitive, physical, social, and emotional well-being of children, the amount of time 6 to 8-year-olds spend playing creatively has been declining dramatically over the past decade. And for 9 to 12-year-olds over the same period, creative play has declined a staggering 94%.
The thing that it's important to remember about creative play is that it's a foundation of learning. It's the foundation of critical thinking. It's the foundation of problem solving. It's the foundation of empathy and of, you know, the experience of being something else. And it's the way that kids make life meaningful. What's happening is that children are being deprived increasingly of opportunities to exercise their imagination. Parents are being encouraged to hand babies cell phones because of the Sesame Street content or the Nickelodeon content. We now have, you know, screens in the back of minivans and portable DVD players for toddlers. We're raising a generation of children who are never going to have the experience of having to amuse themselves or having to calm themselves down. And so they're always going to need a screen, and that's exactly where the marketing industry wants them.
And when children play with toys that are based on media products, they play less creatively because they're not spurred to make up their own world.
She's a Fiesta girl.
Move your arms up and down, shake your head.
They're not spurred to make up their own storylines. What they do is they just regurgitate what they've already seen using products that are based on the film or on the television show.
Every flip, every stick, every web sling and trick Spider-Man can do, now you can too with the Spider-Man stunt system.
It's not real play. Their own imagination and their own past experience isn't evident. It's really just an imitation of what they've seen.
You can be just like Superman. With a Superman Returns Inflato-Suit, strap on the punch and crush gloves, and you'll hear the sound of every punch you throw and everything you crush. The world needs a hero. Are you ready for the job? Inflato-Suit accessory. You put it together, batteries not included. Punch and crush gloves sold separately.
The message kids get is that they can't play Harry Potter unless they have an official Harry Potter wand. Or they can't play some hero unless they have all of the paraphernalia that goes with it.
Straight from the movie comes Jack Sparrow's gear. Battle with the Clash and Flash sword with lights and sound effects. Fire the electronic pistol. Be Jack Sparrow.
And in a way, they're being told their imagination isn't good enough. It's not good enough to pick up a stick and turn it into a wand. You have to have the real wand.
It's, okay, the newest, greatest robot toy that does everything for you, and you don't have to play with it anymore. It just plays by itself, and you watch it. Great, and at a cost. I don't even put the thing together anymore. It's no model making, no thinking, no coloring, no painting it. It's just all ready for me and ready to go.
The fundamental message that I need something outside of myself in order to play is really harmful and tragic, because it starts to take play out of children's hands. So the kids need more and more and more in order to be able to play and in order to be happy.
We're creating a future generation of super consumers. Rather than consuming less,
our children will consume even more than the baby boom generation or the Generation Y or X. What does that mean for our future, for our well-being, and for their well-being?
Forty times as many young people are now being diagnosed with bipolar disorder than 13 years ago.
Attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Almost 4.5 million children in this country have been diagnosed with ADHD.
Doctors are writing a growing number of prescriptions for antidepressants for children, as many as 8 million a year.
One in three children born in the year 2000 will develop diabetes.
The first time in decades, the rate of hypertension in children is rising.
This generation of children is the heaviest in American history. An estimated 16% of all children and teenagers are overweight, four times as many since the 1960s.
It's kind of like we're saying in our society, we don't care about children. For all the rhetoric about kids, we're treating them as one thing, buying power consumers. And it, you know, no matter what they buy, we want them to buy, even if it's going to kill them.
The sick child, as view a consumer, has replaced the healthy child of sports, play, and make-believe.
People who are really smart, who've done a lot of research on this, are beginning to say, wait a minute, there seems to be some association here between advertising and marketing and all these problems.
I designed a study which looked at children's involvement in consumer culture. And what I found was the more media a child used, both television and other forms of media, the more likely they are to score high on a depression scale and an anxiety scale.
This is one of the very most important public health problems in the United States, if not the most important public health problem in the United States.
And one of the most disturbing of these negative health trends is the rise of illnesses linked to childhood obesity. The dark side of a kid's consumer culture that promotes junk food and sedentary media use over physical exercise.
Life expectancy of kids today will be shorter than that of their parents, the first such decline in modern times.
Over the last two decades, obesity rates have doubled in children and tripled in teenagers.
One of the concerns that people have with our current pandemic of obesity is that we are teaching kids to eat the wrong kind of things earlier and earlier.
The consequences of America's weight problem now extending to child safety seats. A new report says many very young children are too heavy for standard car safety seats. Manufacturers are starting to make heftier models to address the problem.
And we are seeing problems that we used to never see until adulthood, now in children as young as 6 or 7, such as type 2 diabetes. Diabetes is a terrible disease with lifelong implications. You die young, you die miserable.
This is not diabetes that is based on genetics. This is diabetes based on weight. Diabetes being a chronic illness affects people's eyes, it affects their circulation, it affects their heart. There is going to be a health care crisis, a concrete health care crisis.
Despite these concerns, regulators have not only been reluctant to address the problem, but even to acknowledge that there is one.
There are no simple solutions to this problem. Look, even our dogs and cats are fat. And it's not because they're watching too much advertising.
So you're saying advertising has had no impact on the increased obesity problem?
I'm saying that if you look for a correlation and causation, there is none.
There's no way we can really make childhood healthy in this country without a government effort. We've done it in other areas. We do it in the area of child safety. We have laws about putting helmets on kids, seatbelt laws, tobacco marketing to kids. But somehow we think it's okay to make children fair game for marketers who just want to profit from them, irrespective of the impacts on their health and well-being.
Not once have I ever heard a corporation say, let's put on the chalkboard the pluses, the maybes, the questionable impact, and here's some negatives that could come out of our product or program. I've never seen it.
If I'm a producer and distributor, I don't think it's fair for me to say, well, I don't care what the social consequences of what I do are. I'm just making a buck. I mean, we wouldn't tolerate that in a lot of other areas.
The marketing industry spin is that it's all up to parents and that parents should be the sole gatekeepers.
uncivilized.
What about their parents, though?
The parents are responsible for the conduct of the child.
Anything a child does.
Isn't it a parent's responsibility?
Isn't it the parent's responsibility to monitor what their kids are reading and watching?
Isn't the choice of what to buy and feed kids up to parents, ultimately?
Parents can't cope with this alone. They need help. We have a $15 billion industry that is working day and night to undermine parental authority.
Responsible adults would say that, of course, parents are responsible. But if children are not with their parents 24 hours a day, if they're in school and the school is full of advertising and marketing, if they go to daycare and the daycare center is full of advertising and marketing, if they're, someone's inviting them over to a slumber party, and there's a surreptitious selling or market research going on there, I think it's asking an awful lot of parents to take all the responsibility. It's akin to a owner of a large fleet of trucks announcing that our fleet of trucks from now on is going to be barreling down the road, especially where children are, at 150 miles an hour. Parents, watch out. It's your job to take care that your children don't get hurt. No one would argue in that case that the owner of the fleet of trucks doesn't bear any responsibility at all.
In fact, the FTC and the FCC's role is to protect children when the marketplace isn't protecting them. And we have a situation now where those agencies are not fulfilling the role that they actually were given when airwaves, for example, were turned over to private corporations. So things are very out of balance.
We're the only industrialized country in the world that really doesn't have a policy about this. I have consulted and spoke to people in Ireland, in the Scandinavian countries. They don't permit this type of advertising. But usually when there is any type of debate about this, the industry brings out the First Amendment rights, okay, the Constitution. I say they're entitled to the Constitution, but they're also entitled to the shame. Shame on them. This is our future, and they know that this is wrong.
We need, in a proactive, forward-looking way as a society, to say, how is this changing us? How is this changing our environment? How is this changing our society? And do we want this?
I think that we have to look at this as an issue of rights. The rights of children to grow up and the freedom for parents to raise them without being undermined by commercial interests. In that sense, it's like the civil rights movement or the women's movement or the environmental movement. I think that we're at the beginning of a growing movement, and that it takes time.
This is a lot more than about selling products and services. If we care about nourishing the human spirit, if we care about human relationships, we've got to care about this issue.
The psychopath's relations with others are superficial, surface, very, very little depth. Mostly style over substance, and the idea is to impress other individuals, to somehow put them in a position where you can manipulate them and so forth. And a corporation, I imagine, would be not unlike that in many respects. They would have public relations firms. They would be spending half their time and a lot of their budget on trying to present a particular image to other people. And this image is a very superficial, and you never really get to know the real corporation. You're going to see what they want you to see. A psychopath is also a grandiose individual, has a very powerful sense of self, believes that he or she is the center of the universe, better, smarter than everybody else. Corporations, I suppose, almost by their very nature, would have to adopt this particular attitude. If they took the stance that they were, in fact, inferior to every other company, they're probably not going to get very far. So I imagine that they would spend an awful lot of time explaining to others and to themselves that we're number one, we're the best. The psychopath is also very manipulative, tends to manipulate, con, and deceive other people to try and mold them into something that they can use. Remember, the psychopath is really a predator, and as a predator, you're trying to groom and put your prey in the right position for where you can make some use of this particular object, is the way they would see them. Would a corporation be the same? To a very large extent, I would imagine so, because what you're trying to do is manipulate everything, including public opinion, for one thing. And imagine in a sales meeting where you're trying to get everybody pumped up, you've got to have to, you know, rah-rah, you've got to manipulate them, get them into a position where they actually believe in something that they may not have believed in before. Psychopath lacks empathy. And this simply means that it's very difficult or impossible for a psychopath to put himself inside the emotional skin of somebody else. They may understand at some sort of superficial level that this person is going through what could be construed as an emotion by other people, but I don't understand what it is. This is a psychopath's position. Would a company or a corporation actually lack empathy? Well, maybe by definition they would have to. If you're concerned about the fate of your competitors, and also the general public, you may not have profits that are so respectable. And so I suppose this corporation could lack empathy in the sense that the psychopath does. Lacks remorse is another characteristic that defines psychopathy. That is, having done something, you don't feel badly about it. Corporation, I imagine, would be much the same, unless one is caught. Now, a psychopath who is caught for committing a crime, the first thing he'll say is, yeah, I'm really sorry I did it, I feel remorse, but only when caught. And I imagine that most corporations would be much the same. If some sort of regulatory body finds out what you're doing, and if it's considered to be illegal, I would imagine that they would say, well, yes, we're really sorry, but otherwise they're not likely to do that. Psychopath doesn't accept responsibility for his or her own behavior. Usually, diffusion of responsibility is the name of the game for the psychopath. Somebody else made me do it. It wasn't my fault. It was fate. And I'm not really responsible. Corporations would do this almost routinely, I would imagine. In fact, they would have public relations personnel whose only job is to make sure that this image is portrayed to the general public as, somebody else, it was fate, it was a political decision, or it was not, the market suddenly crashed and there was a war in some other place and this accounted for everything. Psychopaths tend to be impulsive, but in a fairly controlled sense. That is, most psychopaths are not going to do things if there's an external control present. The psychopath standing on the street corner is not going to commit a crime with the policeman standing right next to him. On the other hand, if the policeman is not there, if the external control is not there, then it's possible that he or she will do whatever he feels like doing if he has a chance of getting away with it. Are corporations impulsive? It's difficult to actually evaluate this, but I would imagine so. In some cases, particularly if the corporation is not well structured, if the rules and the of behavior and the hierarchical structure is not firmly in place, then it would be very possible for a corporation to act impulsively. Of course, if you do this, then you run the risk of actually experiencing fairly serious losses. Psychopaths don't have long-term goals. Most of the things that they're striving for are short-term, and could refer to as a short-term form of hedonism. And corporations, I imagine, are much the same way. In fact, one could argue that sacrificing short-term profits for the long-term potential of making profits would not be in the company's best interest. So almost by their very nature, they would have to lack long-term goals. And some corporations, of course, would have a long-term strategy, but at the same time, they'd have these short-term goals that are firmly in place. They've got to go to the next stockholders meeting, for example, and show that there's a profit. Poor behavioral controls is another characteristic that defines a psychopath. These are individuals who are likely to lose their temper very easily, to strike out and do things that are fairly irrational in the short term, but they do it in a very controlled manner. They know what they're doing. It could be a reaction to frustration and so forth. Corporations, this is very difficult for me to evaluate this, to translate directly into the corporate field. I suppose it could be possible, but I'd have to think about that for some, another 4 or 5 years, I think. Psychopaths tend to be irresponsible, and that means that their behavior doesn't take into account what's likely to happen to somebody else. They will put others at risk. Their own behavior puts other people at risk all the time. This could be in driving, it could be in their personal relations or anything they do in their general life. And corporations, I imagine, could be irresponsible in exactly the same way. That is, in an attempt to satisfy the corporate goal, everybody else is put at risk. This could be other companies. As a matter of fact, I suppose one could argue that this is good in the business sense. I mean, if your competitors fall by the wayside because you are acting irresponsibly with respect to them, that's good, as long as you get some sort of goal out of that, some sort of benefit. Psychopaths also tend to engage in behavior that is antisocial or at least asocial from a very early age, and this continues on throughout most of the lifespan. And by this I mean their behavior is not necessarily criminal in the strict sense of the term, but in fact it's harmful to other people, other individuals. May not take into account the fact that your behavior is going to have negative consequences for somebody else. Corporations could be much the same, and this ties in with irresponsibility to a certain extent, that what they're doing with respect to the general public and to other companies would clearly be looked at, viewed as, or construed as asocial or antisocial. We just don't really care.
As governments squeeze education spending, corporations are increasingly filling the void, giving generously in return for new marketing opportunities. It's more than simply providing vending machines and team uniforms. Some businesses are finding ways to influence what children are taught. Critics say it's all aimed at teaching them to be good consumers before they're taught how to be good citizens. Here's filmmaker Jill Sharp with Corporations in the Classroom.
Volunteers from the local Home Depot have arrived at this school in Kitchener, Ontario, to build a playground.
Okay. Home Depot has given our school some money so that they are going to help build us a playground.
The deal is the schools raise one-third of the costs, $10,000, and Home Depot provides the rest in materials and volunteer labor. And everybody gets to feel really good about it.
We at Home Depot believe in volunteerism, and we believe in giving back to our communities, and it's just part of our DNA.
So 250 adults, role models for the kids, get to pat themselves on the back after a hard day's work. The school saves money and gets a playground. And Home Depot? What Home Depot gets is access to the fastest growing market in Canada, our children.
How many of you have been to Home Depot? Absolutely wonderful. Point the direction that Home Depot is.
The U.S. head office of the hardware giant Home Depot has committed to building 1,000 playgrounds in 1,000 days all over North America. This is more than a playground. It's a strategy. What corporate America has done in the last few years is target education. It's become a specific marketing ploy. And where schools need extra cash or equipment, there's a company somewhere willing to help out.
And some of the older schools, of course, have playgrounds, and you never think to ask, like, how long has that playground been here? Who paid for it? When was it built? When was it designed? Sometimes we just don't stop and think about those things. But in this case, we didn't have one, and we had to come up with it on our own.
I think it's an excellent win-win situation. I don't think any money is wasted by Home Depot at all for this. I think they will get it back probably 100-fold. Obviously, we as a school community win huge, and they as a company may get a few extra customers.
A few extra customers and a lot of corporate identity. This is not just random big business charity. Getting into schools is a huge part of current advertising and marketing policy. They're spending about $2 billion a year, targeted right here in the public school. And no opportunity is missed. And it's not just about bathroom advertising or playgrounds. In Canada and the U.S., public schools have been setting up foundations to attract additional funding. Here in Newburyport, Massachusetts, they need a lot more than swing sets. What the schools around here have done is rely on people with marketing expertise. Experts whose job specifically is to bring in some big cash for everything from gyms to science labs. In Newburyport, Christine Walsh is selling naming rights.
The naming rights idea came about because the high school was being renovated and there was an opportunity to get some revenue income, and I believe the idea came from what colleges do and what private schools do.
With the right amount of cash, a company can put its name on a plaque on the wall, and there are other opportunities.
This is our library. We're going to go ahead and sneak in quietly. I believe it was $3,000 for the reading room. The library is still for sale for $100,000. To make a bid, make an offer, and name a sheet. $5,000. I believe it was $10,000. $600,000. The new Knock Middle School Science Lab.
You can't have the floor of the gym. They've already sold that to a bank in exchange for a science lab.
These are the logos for the Institution for Savings. This is the gymnasium at the high school that has been newly renovated, and that the naming rights have been given to the Institution for Savings for their donation.
Mark Welch is the bank president who put up the money to have kids run all over his name.
We're in a hotbed for science and biotech in the greater Boston area, and here 30 miles north we've got these science labs that look like they came out of the Soviet Union. It was awful. The bank has been around since 1820. We're the second oldest mutual savings bank in the United States. We've got a terrific commitment to the community.
The donation was made, says Mr. Welch, with the best of intention. The naming rights were simply a sweetener to the deal.
I'm a little embarrassed by the naming opportunities. We didn't do it for the naming opportunities. They were there and we took them. But we became aware that they were there after we made the donation. So it was, you know, it was cart chasing the horse to some degree. I mean, we're a little tiny savings bank in Newburyport, Massachusetts, so we're not going to be able to fix the microscopes for the kids in the Midwest and so on. But we know that it's a national problem. I think it gets solved one city at a time and one school at a time.
So the fact that not all schools are in the lucky position that we are, I feel bad for that. And I wish there was some way that we could all get to this point.
Is this a bad idea? To put corporations in charge of which types of schools will get new floors, extra wings, big gymnasiums, you know, huge teleconferencing labs. Is that the role in society?
Our principal just announced that the Institution for Savings gave my school $600,000 for the improvement of our science labs. I don't really like science, but I will probably want to do experiments.
There's an inherently disequalizing quality to these partnership activities. It really says that every school can't be good, every school can't serve its children well, but those smaller number of schools that happen to have active philanthropists, those schools, they can be good. As long as the sponsors, of course, are given proper recognition.
And recognition, after all, is what it's all about. It's called product placement.
This is a math textbook. It's an M&M's textbook where you learn to count. And we got this from a grade one teacher whose daughter brought it home. They're given this in school. And it's quite lovely because what you do at the beginning of the book is you open up your bag of freshly purchased M&M's, you drop them on the countertop, and now you're ready to learn how to count.
Rules. That's fun.
Yeah, it is fun. There's no question.
The kit. For kindergarten, Dr. Rabbit and the Legend of the Tooth Kingdom, with a teacher's guide and a video and posters again, and storybooks, and 35 samples of Colgate toothpaste, these little ones. Colgate is just everywhere. I mean, Colgate's logo is in this case actually on what the students get. And so getting teachers to do your marketing for you is I guess it's a good deal if you can pull it off, right? But this one makes me, as a teacher, this one would make me very uncomfortable.
Candies and toothpaste are being welcomed into schools all over North America because schools need money. And parents are willing to get into some uncomfortable positions to find it. In the backcountry of Oregon, the community of Long Tom Grange hasn't escaped the government cuts to public education.
Our schools were literally falling apart. The home ec department had closed down. And then the shop closed down. And then we lost our media specialist, which is a high-tech name for a librarian that handles all the research projects in the school. Then we lost our drama department. And of course, we lost arts and music long time ago. So what did we have left? We didn't even have math books.
The teachers and parents in this part of Oregon had tried the traditional methods of fundraising, but they had run dry.
And we couldn't sell enough cookies and enough buns at bake sales to raise anywhere near the kind of money to supplement what was going on in the schools.
And so to raise money, Danuta Pleifer approached the local community of conservative farming people and made an outrageous suggestion.
When I first brought it up, they laughed me out of the room. Really? I was standing there in the Grange Hall, and I said, you know, I think we really could raise some money here. It will raise eyebrows, and that's what's going to raise money. Well, they thought I had lost my mind.
On the count of three, all right, gentlemen, I want you to take your towels in your left hand, or whatever hand you got them in, and then I want you to let them go. All right.
What she was proposing was hardly original. After all, nude calendars of young women and beefy firefighters were quite common.
Where's the beef? All right.
The twist here was in getting a bunch of conservative old farmers to drop them for education. And it sent the community of Long Tom into a bit of a spin.
Boy, the quilters really took sides, too. I mean, Mrs. August walked in the room and everybody stopped talking. Some people turned their backs on Mrs. August. You know, so it was. It became a real delicate, tense, emotional, risky thing to do for this community. And still, nobody had seen a calendar yet.
But at the end of the day, the quilters were defeated. And the farmers shed their inhibitions and their overalls and made a political statement about school funding.
One of our state senators had to actually take the calendar, open it up, and show it to our state legislators and say, look what people have to do. They're dropping their drawers to raise money for schools. Isn't that shame on us?
The calendar is still for sale. And so far has raised $250,000 for the grandchildren of the naked farmers and citizens of Long Tom Grange. Across Canada and the United States, fundraising like this has become the norm, and school boards are turning to wherever they can for cash. And there is no lack of marketing opportunity. For in a world of getting your message out, this is more than a school bus. It's a radio station. An hour outside of Boston, the neighboring communities of Monson and Palmer have each been approached by a new marketing concept called bus radio. And both school administrators are considering it, seriously.
I received this pamphlet in the mail. Bus radio, free to all schools. And it's basically talking about it's a bus safety program is what they make the pitch here.
Without a doubt, as dollars for education, I think, have become more limited, school systems has forced to look for partnerships. And partnerships come with commercials and commercialization.
I think it's the revenue that's really raised our eyebrows more than the safety. I don't think that in this district, we don't view that we have a safety problem on our buses, nor a behavior problem.
I wish education was funded at a level where we wouldn't have to do those things.
The revenue estimate for our size was approximately $5,000 for this particular year.
Bus radio guarantees advertisers a captive audience on their way to and from the classroom. And they're using the schools of Massachusetts as a pilot project. It's a tempting decision for cash-strapped school administrators.
I always say that superintendents are always sticking their necks out, and I've always said that giraffes are the one animal that can see the forest for the trees. So I think that's good guidelines for superintendents or administrators who are faced with tough decisions.
In Monson, these long-necked decisions seem to be crying out for a guillotine. And the parents of the community were already sharpening the blade.
We have questions, and why hasn't the school committee held, you know, public hearings on this? And why hasn't there been more information home? Why wasn't a survey sent home to parents? Is this something you would like? Is this something you wouldn't like?
Oh, elbow!
As I look further into it, I saw there's essentially no benefit for our school district. We're placing our children, who are a captive audience, on a public school bus that our tax dollars have paid for at the hands of an advertising company, essentially a marketing firm that wants to make profit.
The advertisers are hoping that kids will actually listen to the radio on the bus. The kids might have other ideas.
Some kids like to read. Most kids actually like to socialize, though, like with their friends. And some kids, believe it or not, actually do their homework on the bus.
I'd rather listen to the radio in the car than on the bus. I usually just talk to my friends, and I usually bring some of my rock collection on, and people look at them.
In Boston, where they know a thing or two about starting revolutions, the bus radio concept was not exactly welcome. Parents and academics took to the streets in protest.
Well, yeah, she's
hit with an apple.
He'll be going to kindergarten next year, and he'll be riding a school bus. So the thought of bus radio makes me really unhappy.
You know, they're a captive audience, and it's commercial radio. Imagine that.
Bus radio, hey, hey. Oh, oh. We're turning off bus radio, hey, hey.
We need legislation as well, you know. In Quebec, you can't advertise to kids under 13.
It's opening a hornet's nest in terms of schools making available to marketers children.
It seemed everybody in Massachusetts was getting angry about school board decisions to buy into the notion of advertising on school buses.
We put together a petition and had many community members, I think a couple of hundred, sign these letters to the school committee.
In Monson, the parental disapproval and petitions changed the mind of the school administrators, and they finally said no to bus radio. But in Palmer, with money even tighter, the administrators are hoping to go ahead and get $5,000 in exchange for morning broadcasts, like this one.
Bus Radio.
That sucks. Tickets at busradio.com. We'll choose a name at random, and if you're the winner, we'll give a pair of tickets to your bus driver, too. You guys can hang out together, maybe share a large Coke.
Ball fair over third and down the line.
Email us as soon as you get home. Sucks tickets at busradio.com.
As bus radio expands into four states, they may soon head north. But that's not all the corporations have in mind for enhancing public education. And if you think they're watching too much TV at home, just imagine 7 million kids forced to watch commercial messages on school TV as part of the morning class. In this inner city school, for the last 19 years, generations of children have started their class with 10 minutes of television news and 2 minutes of hard commercials, brought to 7 million kids every day in America by Channel One.
We're probably going to get 42-inch plasmas. We're going to get EDTVs TVs instead of HD TVs. We don't have the signal yet. But we're going to mount one over there, up on that wall. It's from the fourth floor. And then we're going to mount one over up here on the concrete, so you can see it from the fifth floor. You know, having this is great. We're going to have scrolling announcements. We're going to have, we'll be able to keep Channel One on all day out here.
Today on Channel One, a look at the new.
The good folks at Channel One will provide free television sets to every classroom. And all they want in exchange is that the kids watch 12 minutes a day.
Hey guys, welcome to Channel One. I'm Alexander Marquardt. It's almost the weekend, but before then, we've got a great show for you. Mika Nichols is at the White House with the story.
The president has signed a bill that he says could keep some illegal immigrants out of the U.S.
We thought about it as a faculty, and we decided that the exchange for the equipment, for the chance to see a quality program targeting young people, in exchange for showing a few commercials, which many of the students would see anyway, was not a trade-off that we couldn't live with.
But it was a trade that one man in Alabama decided he couldn't live with. Jim Metrock, who describes himself as an old-fashioned capitalist, has now retired from his family steel business. He now spends his days battling the growth of what he sees as wolves in the classroom. For 10 years, Metrock has become the shepherd in the campaign against Channel One.
We live in a real world. Give whatever you're going to give to the school. Let them put your name in the newsletter or let them put a name on a plaque. That's fine. Just don't mess up the curriculum. Don't take time away from school children like Channel One does. Don't make these kids listen to your forced advertising. You know, that's a lost instructional week of school a year if they watch Channel One.
In California, a wildfire
what
in the winter.
What much of this commercial use of schools is all about is it's a form of indentured servitude.
And touching off fires across
they loan a needy school equipment, which they can never own.
Gatorade presents the play of the week.
And then it is paid off. It is worked off. Not by the superintendent who approves the contract, and not by the school board or the teachers, but by the kids. They have to watch this show 12 minutes a day and exchange something of economic value, their attention, just to be able to pay the debt. And the kids lose a week's worth of school a year. These kids' rights are being abused simply because a company has something and they dangle it in front of a needy school system. I think that's terrible.
We're in some ways in such a crisis in public education that anything you can get. I mean, if you're not sacrificing your mission and who you are and you're able to create these partnerships, then, you know, I'm willing to consider anything because it's that important to make sure that these students get what they need.
When I started this, Channel One was talking about being the next MTV. They had plans for Channel One movies. It would be a Channel One brand, Channel One clothing. They wanted to resonate in the malls of America. And basically, we ruined their brand. And they spent a lot of money trying to create a brand, and we undid it. This is probably the most visited site on my website. That here are some examples of what your child, if they graduated in 2006, as they've seen in middle school and high school. We have Dude, Where's My Car, which was a stoner movie, a movie that normalized drugs. Channel One had a big ad campaign for that. Here's a man in a bathtub with two women selling a Sims game that a lot of parents might have a problem with. They will sell an anchor position to somebody who wants to plug their latest movie, CD, or TV show. I think it is an abomination of what they, what a news show should be about.
You've probably
Alex
noticed.
Molnar heads up a research institute examining the commercialization of public education.
Of the 42 or so million American school children in public schools, about 35 million, give or take, are regularly subjected to commercial message in some systematic way in the schools that they attend.
In talks like this, across the continent, the responses from people in his audience are remarkably consistent.
I want to introduce myself, and thank you. I'm a parent in Lunenburg, Massachusetts. We have Channel One in our middle school, and I'm all worked up after your presentation. And I wanted to thank you for explaining to me why when I told our principal that my daughter would be getting up and leaving the Channel One broadcast, he responded with, well, your daughter also has the right to get up and leave during the pledge. And I was flabbergasted by that. You know, I didn't understand it, but now I think I do.
that's part of the ugliness of it, because they attach themselves to this social group, in this case a classroom.
Right.
And your child is made the other, the exception,
yeah,
the oddball, and has to bear the weight of that.
I think she's lucky because she has four or five of her friends who are also getting up and walking out of the classroom.
Oh, that is lucky.
So that is helping her. But we didn't understand that response. And I think now as I look into this more, there's this larger thing going on behind the scenes that I doubt even her principal understands what
it.
He was
it's
saying
so,
to me when he
so
said that.
It's so perfectly connected these days.
Yeah.
It's very hard for people to even see any space between political democracy and market choice.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
The market rules. It is democracy.
We have a victory already. You don't have to wait until there's no more Channel 1. I think there's about 4 million kids who don't have Channel 1 in their lives anymore, and their siblings coming up don't have it in their lives. That's a great success.
When a Channel 1 equivalent was proposed in Canada a few years ago, it was stifled by outraged parents and teachers before it could get off the ground. While marketers saw it as a powerful tool, Canadians with kids in schools saw it as an insidious intrusion. But even the most active parent groups would have difficulty detecting the slick marketing tricks they're planning here. At an advertising industry conference in Toronto, marketers have gathered to discover the latest trends in getting their products into the minds and hearts of the iPod generation.
I don't know.
One of the major attractions here is advertising guru Chip Walker from BBDO, the third largest advertising agency in the world.
Teen culture, in fact, has never been more important just because it's such a large group now, over a billion teens worldwide. A lot of them have their own money. They have their own cell phones, they have their own technology, they have their own media and websites.
They also have their own activists. Carly Stasko, in training to be a school teacher, has arrived outside the conference with her own particular commercial message.
And I'm an expert on marketing to young people. You've got some awesome young people here. I mean, I bet you the cool hunters are going crazy over you guys right now, trying to take pictures of you and put it on their website so they can sell your brand as cool and get you to sell it right back to you. But I'll tell you, you know who wants to understand you? You know who really wants to understand you? Not your parents, not your teachers, not your politicians, marketers.
Well, historically, marketers have thought about positioning their brand and sort of blasting their message as loud as they could in order to sort of gain a quote-unquote real estate inside your brain. So we've always sort of called that marketing warfare, and it's the way a lot of marketers, including myself, were trained in business school. It appears with this generation that that is not going to work. They have a highly developed capability of tuning messages out.
What marketers have had to do is find audiences that can't switch the channel, that can't go to a different website, that can't walk away or can't roll their eyes. And so what they do is they get kids to market to each other, or they have it integrated in their school learning experience, so that it's like it's totally integrated into their lives.
Today we're thinking about something we call engagement. It means I try to involve you in my brand, maybe only once, but in a way that's meaningful and interesting to you. Having that experience is worth seeing 55 television commercials.
Everybody wins.
But if the conference had come up with a way to connect with youth, they weren't exactly ready to share it with Carly Stasko.
I am going to go with my own people because you guys just don't get it. I'm sorry.
Are you registered?
Yes.
Do you have your badge?
Yes.
That's not a badge.
Yes.
No.
Standing under youth?
No.
Standing under youth, shaking them upside down, getting all the change from their pockets.
Is that what you're doing?
Well, that's what I thought you guys were doing. Okay. So yeah, denial. That's what I'll try. I'll try denial. Maybe that'll help me with my problems, my ethical problems. I don't have a problem. I'm cool with it. And take care, guys. Keep up the good work. Hey, how's it going? Oh, man, I'm having a bad business day. Yeah, I just tried my business pitch and it didn't really work very well.
How's that make you feel?
Made me feel pretty shitty.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know.
So what are you gonna do about it?
Keep selling.
I think that there is a way to connect with kids in schools, but I think it's much more by a soft sell than a hard sell. if a company is able to help a school with equipment or a program or something that betters the student body population, if kids know that a company cared enough to do that, that in and of itself, I think, will enhance the brand.
Good morning, boys and girls.
Enhancing the brand is what we're doing here.
Does anybody remember back to when I was first telling you what our school can get for doing this testing?
Can't remember? Think on it for a minute, Kevin.
Exercise.
Well, of course. That is a really important thing. Austin?
For the, for money?
Yeah, good for you. We can earn some money for our school that we can use to buy more PE equipment. So, how can we use it? Well, I believe that the...
Where'd you get the money
from? Money is coming from the Go Active Fitness program, and there is a sponsor that is working with these people, and it's somebody you know pretty well, actually.
No.
McDonald's. Yeah, McDonald's is sponsoring this.
You know what I would do if I was a fast food company?
What would you do?
I would promote exercise. And I would go all around the country, and I would go to schools, and I would tell kids to exercise. And everybody would think that I was such a great little fast food company. And I would just tell people to exercise, exercise, exercise. And I would distract them from thinking about eating all of the junk I was selling.
Decades ago, school children across the country had their egos crushed as they went through the Canada Fitness program. There were sprints and jumping and chin-ups and medals handed out to recognize your level of fitness. Gold, silver, and lots of bronze. The government no longer runs that program, but now McDonald's has generously stepped in and offered schools the chance to win $200 worth of free gym equipment in what it calls its Go Active Fitness Challenge. It's a marketing partnership between the Hamburger Corporation and the Canadian Olympic Committee. And as a piece of advertising, it's all very subtle.
You have to look really hard to see those logos. Why? I wonder why they're there. I mean, if they're so little, they're so tasteful, they're so innocuous, couldn't they just not be there?
I do think that businesses have a responsibility to the community, and by providing opportunities for kids, what they're doing is they're fulfilling their responsibility. So it's not an opportunity to advertise.
It's either altruism or it's marketing. Which is it?
We're going to get new equipment and stuff, and the McDonald's people are going to give us money.
Good, good, good. Stop.
I think the fact that they are providing monies to purchase equipment, which is going to help in the development of activity levels, is a good thing. I think if the incentive had been free food, I think I probably would not have participated.
One of the problems in schools now is that there isn't enough gym space and there isn't enough gym equipment. So the problem is we need the equipment. And so this is going to be very tempting for teachers in schools. You really can't turn down, in lots of ways, $200 worth of gym equipment for students. On the other hand, why is McDonald's doing this?
Ron Christensen is the head of corporate communications for McDonald's Canada.
The thing with us is that we have always been involved in sport and developing programs for youth.
Mr. Christensen is anxious to promote the fitness challenge and the new healthy treats now available at McDonald's, with or without fries.
Can I get some apple slices, please?
That's the goal, is just to have them focus on the physical activity. Again, it's not about food, it's about activity. It's about the what I do part as opposed to the what I eat part.
That's contradicting what they say. Supersize this, but then score a goal. You know, so
it's terribly ironic that a company like McDonald's, which sells wholly unhealthy food, would want to get behind something like a sporting event
guess it's sort of nice to think for a second that McDonald's would be really caring about your children's well-being, but I think it's just sort of a PR thing that they're just trying to keep their image nice.
Tell me, what is your most popular food item?
The Big Mac. The Big Mac is our most popular food item.
How long do you think it'll take for apple slices to catch up?
It's hard to say.
Back in Surrey, BC, McDonald's has returned to Royal Heights Elementary, this time to host an Olympic Day run.
When we're looking at the school as being a potential marketing environment, I mean, you are looking at an institution that is highly respected in the community, people feel close to. You're looking at an institution that has mandatory attendance laws, so if you want to target kids up to the age of 16, you know where they're going to be for 10 months of the year, you know, 7 hours a day, 5 days a week, they're in school.
Good morning, everybody. It is a beautiful day today. Boys and girls, we are about to head into the gym for our very special assembly.
Between 1990 and 2000, 10 years, advertising to children in North America has gone from $100 million to $2 billion.
Very young children can't distinguish between a commercial and a program. And until the age of 8, children can't understand persuasive intent. They can't understand the fundamental basis of advertising. So how is it that they can defend against it?
That's what this is all about. It's all about fitness. Okay, put your hands down.
It's completely naive, to my opinion, to believe that a child, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, even bright child, very well educated about marketing, is strong enough to resist the influence of experts, PhDs in psychology, who use their knowledge, sold their knowledge to a marketing company, and this marketing and company is trying to influence the kid, and the kid will be able to resist that. That's uneven. That's unfair.
My name is Chris Stinnell. I'm from McDonald's Canada, and again, I'm absolutely thrilled to be here.
No marketing ploy is left unturned to connect the Hamburger Corporation to a healthy lifestyle. Ronald McDonald appears to have been replaced by a national hero.
Lit from the sun. Here she is, the best athlete in the world, Cindy Klassen.
And this time, all the medals are gold.
So great, let's have a big round of applause.
Marketing is a factor in so many of the problems that children face today. It's a factor in childhood obesity, eating disorders. It's a factor in youth violence. It's a major factor in the acquisition of materialistic values, the false notion that things will make us happy. So given that we know that marketing is a factor in all of those problems, what is the moral, social, ethical justification for marketing to children?
Well, when I was a little kid, I lived in Manitoba, and I went to a one-room country school. The only kind of corporate influence I can remember was that the map that rolled down at the front of the classroom, the map of the world, had little chocolate bars all around the edge. I didn't see any other branding when I was a little kid in school, apart from those little chocolate bars on the map, which might have been the beginning of a slippery slope.
Well, I've been studying commercialism in schools for over 20 years. The mid-1980s is when I began to look at it in some systematic way and discovered there was an enormous amount of so-called sponsored materials in schools. They brought me boxes full of it. Sponsored educational materials, they are free. And they come in more or less hidden. Many times they're mailed directly to teachers. Many times they go into classrooms and schools in violation of school board policy. But nobody knows how to stop it.
Well, I think that inevitably an industry is going to have a bias.
And it doesn't matter if it's the pork board that wants our children to know that pork is the other white meat. It doesn't matter if it's the plastic bag association that wants our children to know that plastic bags are not more harmful to the environment than paper bags. It really doesn't matter what industry it is. They all want to do the same thing, and that is present a story and an image of themselves with something good rather than something bad.
So have you guys done this drawing before?
Yeah, it's really fun.
Yes? Does it go around the school?
Ready, set, go!
In all species, children, babies are protected against predators. How come within our own species, we allow some people to use knowledge in psychology and use this knowledge to heal people and use it to abuse them? That's horrible. That's antisocial. It's not loving children. It's abusing them to make them wish this product.
It's never been harder to be a parent than it is today, because children are growing up in a commercial culture that is toxic for them. I mean, sometimes parents don't even know the kind of marketing that's going on in schools.
With the McDonald's fitness program, there will be money for new gym equipment and free apple slices for the kids. But this doesn't solve the funding needs for every community. And with government cutbacks to education continuing across North America, some parents are even prepared to spill their blood to get their children a teacher. Back in Eugene, Oregon, the parents in this working-class neighborhood were faced with a bigger dilemma than getting a few dollars worth of gym equipment. They needed to raise $70,000 to keep their school operating. In this neighborhood, there were no state banks to buy a science lab, no companies willing to pay for a plaque on the wall, and no hardware giants ready to build a playground. So the parents decided to try and raise the money they needed by selling their blood plasma at the local medical clinic.
Hi. We are second or third poorest school in the district. I mean, it's not like you're talking families who have a lot of economic resources.
We'll just have you rest your arm right there. Do you want to sit or lie down?
In honesty, I get real nervous about this.
And
I don't like doing it.
Arm?
The process of giving plasma takes almost 3 hours.
Yeah.
Because you take it all out and then you put it back on. They spin it around and then they put it all back in.
It takes the red cells out and the white cells out and it puts the plasma back into your body. Okay. Let's see here. Okay. Some people think it's rather strange to get paid for donating blood or donating plasma, but since they do pay for it, I think it's a great way of giving to the school. It's probably better than a bake sale.
Yeah. This is a part of
only 20 parents finally qualified to sell their blood and plasma. They couldn't raise the money they needed, and there was no corporate interest in supporting them. They raised only $1,500, and their school was closed.
I've got young kids in school, and every year it was something less, something less, something less. And you keep doing more.
At Sullivan Heights High School in Surrey, British Columbia, there was no need to sell blood. What some people said they sold instead was their soul.
Well, this is the Bell Performing Arts Center, and of course Bell is figured pretty prominently on the school. You know, if there's a line, we haven't crossed it. If there's a threshold, we're not there yet. That we're still
pretty much in the comfort zone of being able to carry on our business as usual.
As far as the rationalizing, well, there's an expression that we use called the race to the bottom. Do we want to participate in the race to the bottom? I'm not seeing how over-commercialization is improving public education.
I think we do have to say, here's the line. It's not a public space. If corporations are all competing in it for the attention of future consumers or current consumers.
Because it soon won't be public education.
In British Columbia, the day ends in graduation. In Kitchener, Ontario, with a new playground and a whole bunch of serious questions about how schools in North America have become corporate targets. Not everyone is accepting this new reality. In Sweden, Norway, and Greece, there's now legislation protecting kids from advertising. In the U.S., five states recently banned junk food in schools. And Quebec has outlawed advertising to children under 13. But until education is funded sufficiently by public funds, the corporatization of education is an ongoing marketing strategy, which isn't going away.
So, what's the big deal,
Audrey? What's the purpose of education?
The purpose of education is to teach kids to be good consumers. Buy, 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 buy.
That's Global Currents. To have your say and for more information on this documentary, visit globaltv.com, search word Global Currents. I'm Kevin Newman. Thanks for watching.
What help can I be? Meditate on this. I will. Fear is the path to the dark side. Fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering. Truly wonderful the mind of a child is.